welcome to another edition of Film Grog from a beautiful Film Grog studios in downtown Studio City. This is Serge Delpierre, and today we're going to be doing Conan the Barbarian from what year?
84, I believe.
1984. To my left, I have...
Tim McMillan.
To his left...
Curtis Nelson.
And to my right is...
Heidi Hilliker.
Hi, Heidi. How you doing?
I'm good, thank you. How are you, Serge?
Doing fine. So, how many here are Conan lovers?
Lover. One.
What?
You will find out by the commentary as we go.
Okay.
But yes, Curtis is very big.
I'm a kind of a Milius fan. You, Tim?
I am. I don't think I know as much as the rest of you guys here about the whole body of work, but what I've seen, I like.
Mm-hmm.
But he is a huge Basil Poledouris fan. So
Basil Poledouris is one of my favorite film composers, and you cannot speak Conan without mentioning Basil Poledouris in the same sentence.
One of the most perfect scores to any film.
Basil Roth.
Iconic. Just, it doesn't get better.
Awesome. Yeah.
Yes, he is.
Thank goodness he went as theatrical as he did with the score.
Exactly.
I'm so glad he went as far as he did.
I think he could have gone further.
Ooh. We'll figure it. We'll find out when.
That's right. So
challenge.
So the cue point on this is right after is when the old Universal logo fades to black. That's where we've paused. And
I'm
so
totally
we'll
wrong. It says 81 on the disc. So
oh, dude.
Yeah, 81.
Do I have to 81?
That doesn't seem to make sense, right?
No, actually, it does make sense.
Was it 81?
I thought 84 was a little odd, but I mean, I'll go with it.
Yeah,
my goodness.
Because I thought it was before, this is before Terminator, correct?
Yeah.
And Terminator was 84, so there you go.
Yeah, this was one of his, actually, this was his first big ones. He'd done Stay Hungry before that.
Yeah. And that was like 79.
78, 79 with Jeff Bridges.
But he also did the one where he played the bodybuilder with, who's the woman that was married to Burt Reynolds?
That's Stay Hungry.
No, Stay Hungry, Sally Field and Jeff Bridges. This one was a TV movie.
Sally Field?
No, who's the woman that was married to Burt Reynolds
with Lonnie Anderson.
He did a movie with her where she was playing was it Jane Mansfield?
Yeah.
Jane Mansfield was married to a bodybuilder.
I saw that.
He played the bodybuilder.
Oh.
He actually got nominated for like a Golden Globe for that.
Right. He played Mickey Hargitay.
There you go.
Who is the actual father of Mariska Hargitay, who's on Law & Order SVU.
So there you go.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
That was a TV film.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've never seen this, but I would like to. I'm gonna check it out.
Yeah, it was kind of like, ooh.
And for those people that want to criticize Arnold and his acting, he was actually nominated, I believe, for a Golden Globe. I think that was whatever TV award, maybe an Emmy. Maybe
yeah,
so.
Emmy.
And then, but he was voted up in new
Rise
best
star.
Upcomer or whatever it was or something like that for that movie. So,
well, he did Hercules in New York, correct?
That was an amazing. No, but that was like 72 or something.
Well, I'm just saying his body of work pre,
Conan.
This is really the turning point.
Yeah. Well, people can argue that Pumping Iron is what made him so famous. I mean, because you knew his natural
Well, I mean, that put him on the map. That's what made people know
who he was as a bodybuilder.
You realize that he had a lot of character to him, and he was a very, very big figure as far as besides just his body.
Right. And then that's what led to basically, well, I guess the Jane Mansfield thing and Stay Hungry and then to this. I mean, this was really the one that said, I'm here, I'm an action star, I can carry
I'm a big blockbuster star.
Yeah.
Yes. I can take on James Earl Jones any day. So okay.
And win.
Absolutely. Oh, yes. Thulsa Doom, you're going down. Okay. So if you're ready, we're ready. And what we'll do is we'll count down 3, 2, 1, play, and then we'll all be in sync on this. And
did you let him know the cue point? Did you?
I talked about this before, yeah. So anyway, end of the Universal logo. Oh, there it is. Okay. All right. So 3, 2, 1, play.
It worked.
There's music.
Now, already, you got John Milius right there. Of course, it was Nietzsche, but John Milius is the shit, if I might
even. Hang on. I got to tell my Nietzsche joke.
Go ahead. Tell me Nietzsche joke.
So my Nietzsche joke is, of course, God is dead, Nietzsche.
Mm-hmm.
So then the whole thing is, God is dead, Nietzsche. Nietzsche is dead, God.
Yes, you had to tell that.
Of course I had to, because it's Nietzsche.
But some of the best narration over the beginning title sequences right here. Amazing. And... we just had to be quiet, I think.
I know.
Shh. I hear drums.
Quiet.
Perfect. I guess we should say something for somebody that's in their car that might not be listening to the actual movie.
We're listening to the narration right now, and it's all black, but it's great because
is that Pia Zadora? Who's the narrator?
No, but let's talk about this. Actually, let's talk about it in terms of form. This is really interesting. It's basically narration over black, which you really don't see that much of
anymore.
It's
fantastic, but what a great opening.
But then it comes into this. That's right.
And then to give you an idea of where I stand, of course, Basil Poledaris right now, how could you not get goosebumps already? I've got goosebumps. But if you want to speak about a film that I think is probably one of the most underrated films from the 80s, in my opinion, and I will defend it all the way through this movie, it's this movie. It's well-written, it's well-directed, and it's well-acted, it's well-shot, it's got fantastic music in every single way. It's not cheesy in any way, shape, or form, but yet it still stays true to the comic books of Conan, and is violent as hell. So... And this guy making the sword who plays his dad is William Smith. Not Will Smith, William Smith.
That's William Smith, yeah.
William Smith, who was actually a bodybuilder at one time, actually a very underrated actor as well. He plays the Russian general in Red Dawn because his parents were Russian. He was in tons of Roger Corman films. That's where he kind of made his living, was by all these B films. But he was also probably his most famous role that most people would know him from is Any Which Way You Can. He's the guy that fights Clint Eastwood at the end of the movie.
Yeah, big character actor. I mean, he comes up, pops up all over the place.
Duke Callahan, DP.
Do you know who he is?
No, but I remember he did great work in this movie.
Yeah. And that's the mother.
But this score by Basil is just ridiculous.
This was Basil's demo, basically. He hadn't done, besides Big Wednesday, done a feature film, and this was the one he said, okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to throw everything but the kitchen sink into this score.
And another John Milius film. So, yeah, John Milius met him at USC and also surfed with him. And
Basil?
Yeah, okay. Surfed with Basil and Basil. Both of them were big surfers. And so that's how they knew each other. So he really kind of helped out Basil's career in a lot of ways. I mean, Basil was good enough to get on his own, but, you know.
And with the budget they had,
Oliver Stone
recorded everything in in Rome. The music was recorded in Rome, and he was able to do a much better orchestra for the money that they had in his budget compared to if he had done it in the U.S. So the sound is much better because it was recorded in Rome.
Now look at the clarity and look at the film work right here. I think it's just unbelievable. I mean, if as far as John Milius goes, John Milius is a huge fan of all the Westerns, whether it's John Ford or Sergio Leone. He's actually done commentary on a couple of, Once Upon a Time in the West, he does commentary on that DVD set. So what makes this movie so good and so iconic is, one, he shot it that way, but he also shot it a lot like a Western. So like when you see these broad, wide shots and these huge close-ups, well, that's where he gets it from.
That makes sense, actually. I didn't know that, but that makes a lot of sense how the whole movie flows.
And what I liked about the beginning is it was the whole thing of, essentially, the crafting of the sword.
Yes.
I mean, actually, the making of the sword, which is actually going to become a central figure, a central symbol.
Well,
the whole movie is
about steel.
The sword.
Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, exactly. And that's what makes this movie perfectly made, is because John Milius made it, in my opinion, because John Milius is a total conservative, just right-wing. He's got a seat on the board of the NRA. So he's all about this manly alpha male kind of thing. And so, you know, it fits right into perfectly what Conan stands for and what this movie stands for. So that when they wrote it that way. Whereas, hey, he's a killer and he's a son of a bitch, but he's giving purpose for why he does what he does.
Well, it's not so much that he's a killer. It's that this is the story of him before he eventually becomes king. That's the whole thing.
Sure.
You know, if it was about Conan the Farmer, there never would have made, it wouldn't have been a story. And that's the thing. This is the early part of the origin, if you want, of how he came to be who he was.
If you had to boil this down, would you just say this is a revenge tale?
Oh, it's a total revenge tale, but at the same time, it's got so much heart and it's got a great love story in it. And it's also talks about it points out that how Conan can't love. And it even says that in some of the narration, how he can't love because he can't let himself go to do that anymore because he can't trust the fact that he's going to lose somebody possibly and hurt that bad and become who he was. But it's way on in the future. But when you see the later on when the James Earl Jones monologue comes about, it really knocks the shit out of Conan because he realizes when he says what he said, when False of Doom tells him, I made you. It's because of me why you're as strong as you are and you are able to survive because of me. And it's totally true. But that'll come on up.
I love the choir work in this score.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's very Carmina Burana. It's great.
And here in a second, we're going to get a cameo by Franco Colombo, which is Arnold Schwarzenegger's really good bodybuilding buddy. And, you know, if anybody knows anything about Arnold Schwarzenegger and his bodybuilding, this is him right here. And this is an amazing shot. Look at the lighting coming through here. Now watch this underneath shot right here below it. And how fitting is this score right here, Tim?
It's really accurate. This is really well shot.
Look at that.
This is really, really well shot.
Oh, that's unbelievable.
It's theatrical.
It's fantastic.
I like it, just the theatricality of it all.
Well, it's epic.
Yeah.
You know, and actually...
Operatic.
When you get into the 80s, this is coming out in the very beginning of that decade. There are so many epic films that come out later on, and this is kind of just at the beginning, like right when this kind was catching on.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of fitting, too. I mean, John Milius is kind of a recluse. He's out. He's kind of not a part of the Hollywood norm. Number one, he's like, well, he's John Milius. He smokes cigars. He tells people how it is. And Hollywood isn't real embracing of that type of sensibility sometimes. And he'll even, if you read any articles on John Milius, he's aware of that. And he's aware that a lot of his failings or lack of getting along in Hollywood is kind of stumped his career a little bit, in, especially in modern times today. But look at this. I mean, it's a combination of all the...
Plunder.
Yeah. Now, but it's good you see blood right away.
Oh, well, you see, but it is.
Good to
know,
right.
It's good you see the blood right away, and you actually see blood, not like bad blood. You see good blood. I mean, as in you're going to believe it. Because the point is, these guys are barbarians, and they are killing, so... You know, we want to see what happens.
So well, that's the precedent right away. That I mean, because you see a lot of action movies, and if you're someone like myself, you look for the blood right away, and you know what kind of movie you're going to get into. You know if it's going to be really good, really intense action, or if it's going to be a lot of cutaways.
If they're going to pull their punches,
right away, first battle, blood.
Yes. Yeah.
Good.
And, well, I mean, it's the pillaging of the village, too. I mean, basically, where they're going to kill absolutely everyone.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. But the time in which they take... Well, what I like about this is, once again, no shaky cam. Whoa. This is before all the shaky cam. Everything's wide shot, mixed in with close-ups, good quick cuts.
Yeah.
And for those people that don't know, John Milius is of the world of the... Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, and Francis Ford Coppola, all those guys went to USC together. Mm-hmm. And so he's right in there with some of the best filmmakers of all time. And a lot of people probably don't know that he had a lot to do with those guys' career as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, they all four of them were like, no, the three of them were involved. I think Coppola, Lucas, and Milius were involved with Apocalypse Now at some point or another.
For the people that don't know, John Milius was kind of famous for coming in and doctoring up screenplays. He wrote a lot of his own screenplays, but he also came in and fixed a lot of them. He was the guy that wrote the famous line for Dirty Harry. He would kind of come in and give depth to a character or the story. So the famous Dirty Harry line, where he's like, "This is a Colt 40, it was Smith & Wesson 44. He did that whole monologue, and he wrote that. People don't know Jaws, the famous Indianapolis monologue. He wrote that monologue, brought that in. They brought him in to do that, and on and on and on. He did that all the time for films, a lot of times with no writing credits whatsoever. And, of course, Apocalypse Now, he wrote like in 1968 or 1969 when he was still in film school, and eventually it turned into the movie that it was. But he wrote all those fantastical scenes and everything from that. So he's an amazing writer and doesn't get his due. And a lot of people are, there are people out there that say that he had a lot to do with the success of Star Wars without being ever credited for it, with some of the little do this, don't do that, telling them, you know.
See, I like this. I mean, you know, you don't see a lot of this kind of thing in filmmaking that much.
Well, as far as lack of dialogue and just...
Ceremonial.
The whole ceremonial ritual type thing, where they're taking their time, and this whole thing of, like, even amongst... barbarians, there's
this moment he's letting it build.
Yep.
To this crescendo,
filmmaking wise, yes.
Chops her head off. It's fantastic. Whereas if it was a modern day film,
well,
it was going to get right in there.
If it was another director, it's what he chose to do, and it's just it's interesting that
true
you don't see that a lot, and it's very interesting that he was able to funnel that, I guess, epic or aesthetic into this
film. I just
film.
Like how much of the camera is doing it all without dialogue, and it's camera and music.
And this is James Earl Jones after Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back. So, which kind of basically, look at the eyes.
Yeah. Well, they gave him blue contacts.
Oh, they did.
Yeah.
God, but they look actually very good for that time.
Yeah.
Right.
And for those that don't know, that was a famous lineman. I forget his name right now for the Raiders.
Oh, okay.
He was a lineman for the Raiders. And the other guy that's on his side is a Swedish bodybuilder known through Arnold. But this is amazing. They show how much power mentally he has over people.
Yeah.
And then she decides to lower her sword. And watch right here. You'll actually see her lift her chin. Yep. She's giving her neck up to him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of interesting. But I love that frame of her hand in there. It's going to pay off right here.
It's a nice wig he's wearing. Good hair.
There you go.
Yep.
Great
yep.
cut.
That's a great shot. Ha ha.
I like it, Dan.
That's a great shot. And look how it's then framed with the hand on the other side. Mm-hmm. You see Thalsa in focus and Conan in the foreground is out of focus.
But all of this is... He's just built this kid right now.
Yeah. Yep.
This guy is crazy.
Very operatic. I mean, just that score and the visuals. It's an opera. It's great.
Oh, yeah.
And back to mentioning how, like, a modern-day director probably would have just plowed through this and not given it as much time.
Right.
And it's completely essential, because if you didn't have this moment, if you didn't take the time to breathe here, if you didn't take the time to really look at it, you would never understand Conan as a character.
Sure. Right. Yeah.
But in a modern-day film... they would do that because they would just think this story was throwaway it's a barbarians on another planet and it's based off a comic book.
And then, and once again, they're holding on that False of Doom symbol right there, which is going to be a big part of the whole storytelling going on.
Right.
So, Heidi, how old were you when you first saw this?
I was probably way too young to see it. I'm going to say, I'm actually going to say I was probably 7 or 8 years old.
Yes.
Now,
please don't judge my father.
Your dad is cool.
As an 8-year-old girl, what drew you to this film?
To watch it
in the way you did repeatedly?
I think I just liked the epic story of it. I watched a lot of movies like this when I was younger. I mean, the violence, I don't know. I guess I just kind of got used to the violence of it, and I eventually really, really liked that in movies. But I always kind of liked myth a lot when I was younger, and I find that in comic books, and you know, this is brings both of those things together. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, comic books are just modern day myth.
Yeah.
And I love the epic journey of someone rising up from, you know, against all odds and achieving something. It just, what little kid doesn't love that?
Sure.
Who doesn't want to, like, pull out a sword and, like, run around their backyard? And
mm-hmm. Now, I remember when this came out, saw it in the theater, and, I mean, I was struck by, at least for the time, the violence that we were seeing in movies. This was pretty out there. I mean, especially with beheadings and everything. Of course, this is a time also of Friday the 13th, and we were kind of getting all that thrown at us. Like, what the hell is all this?
Now, I don't know. Do you know, Tim, whether John Milius might have had a conversation with Pep Basil and told him, can we have some Ennio Morricone type of style music here? And just in a second, this is a great piece where the trumpets come in.
Well, I don't know right about here. That, but I do notice is in that establishing shot we just saw, the Wheel of Pain theme came in just as we saw the Wheel of Pain enter from screen right in a pan that was happening visually. Musically, it was perfectly timed. I was very impressed by that.
And this is a great culmination of a heroic shot, and it's both done perfectly directing to me and with the score. Like this right here, to me, is totally Ennio Morricone type
of stuff.
So
this trumpet?
Yeah.
The horns right
this
here?
This trumpet? Is it not?
Well, and look at the sun. I mean, how they have the sun. Can I just say, that set's awesome.
Yeah.
I also
that is an awesome set, and it's not CGI
it's
in the least.
Well, the set at the end, James Earl Jones' Fortress Place, I was blown away by that. That was an awesome set for this budget.
But this is
great location, too.
I
awesome
love
location.
The way they develop this character so quickly, but also take their time in showing you how he became this mammoth man that was able to survive by... You know, and I heard John Milius talk about it one time. They kind of got the idea that they would always bring that redheaded guy you saw, bring him up. He's the guy that's going to be his master here in a second. And
the one that was on the log right there?
Yeah.
Kind on of, the cart.
Kind of, who, like, who was a kid. Was, he yeah, was a kid when kid. He was a kid.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So they were the same age, and he eventually became this guy that would, look, this is a great horror shot.
I love the trench that has been formed to by his repetitive walking pattern.
Is that not great piece of music to go right along with him lifting his head like that? It's amazing.
It's a great reveal.
Oh, and then, of course, you know, it's Arnold.
Camera mounted on the wheel,
but it
there.
Does make sense. You know, it's just like what you said. They do give you a setup that, you know, he could be this giant bodybuilder, mm-hmm. that could grow up into that man because of all the physical labor that he's endured.
Right. And this is like in the middle, they're really crushing grain and stuff. So they're actually getting some productivity out of this wheel. It's not just there just for that reason, but it's there for two purposes, which is to build this warrior. Oh, and at the same time, have some sort of payoff for, like, farming or whatever they use it for. Make tortillas, I don't know.
Or a taco stand.
Hang on. Let me ask about that. I mean, let me ask the logic about this, because I'm a little less familiar with the film than you guys. But, okay, so Thulsa Doom kills everyone in the village, kills mm-hmm. his mom in front of him, and then keeps him alive.
Keeps the kids. He basically sells the kids off to these people right here who bring him
over.
Like,
to slaves.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
It's a very kind of, you know, Spartacus kind of.
Yeah, they're no longer part of Thulsa Doom or whatever.
Yeah. Okay, so they're okay. I thought they were
and
okay.
These guys
so they're
picked
away.
Them up.
Gotcha. All right. Then I'm with you. Little does he know, he's going to come back and get him.
Looks like this would be Spain to me.
It is Spain. He shot this where they shot a lot of the Sergio Leone westerns.
Damn.
Is where they shot it. So all these hillsides and stuff.
Yeah, the hill.
Which is funny because I used to watch all of those movies with my father as well.
Cool. I like your dad.
All just kind
of. Of course you did.
We like your dad.
But one way you can tell it's a Spain is because they had a Spanish Andalusian, that horse. That's what I was going to say. And that, I always love that when you see those. They're very regal. Amazing looking horses, and they've got a very distinct gait and posture to them. But how about this, though? You don't know what the hell's going on. You're totally illiterate, really.
Yeah.
He doesn't know anything. Probably hasn't spoken since he was 12. And they're just going to, like, this guy files his teeth down so he can eat you.
I was going to say.
But what's fun is that us as audience members, we don't really know either, because this is a foreign world to us, so we're in kind of the same boat he is. We don't know what's going to happen.
Welcome to Thunderdome.
But this is total pit fighting.
I love that movie as well.
It's like fight to the death. He doesn't know. I mean, he could have died right here and then, okay, it was all over. But, God, brutal.
But Conan is stronger.
Of course he is, or else there wouldn't be two movies about him.
Oh, there's a second film.
Oh yeah, the Destroyer.
No. I was
don't
saying.
Want to mention it though. We don't want to mention it too much.
Oh, that is brutal.
Cheesy film.
Oh. It is pretty cheesy.
I mean, to go from this is probably why it gets bad rap, because Destroyer came out.
Well, that's the
whole John thing. Did John Milius do it as well?
No, he didn't.
No. That needs to be established.
No, but
then.
That was John Milius didn't do it. They ripped a lot of Basil's score. Basil did a couple of new pieces for it, but for the most part, they just ripped the score from this and put it in that. And it was just really quickly done.
They very classic really 80s sequel.
That one was 84, now that
Punch
I mentioned
out,
it.
Yeah.
It was right after. Okay. Yeah. But, yeah, it was very... I think I saw it on TNT not too long ago, and I my kids were watching part of it, and they were even laughing. They're like, no,
what's the girl, though, that's in it? Because I love her.
Bridget Nelson?
The little short blonde girl that he's protecting.
The Sandal Bergman is in this one.
She's in that one as
Isn't Grace Jones in
Grace Jones.
Grace Jones shows up.
Yeah. She's ridiculous in that movie. Yeah. I'm sorry, but I do love her in that film.
Yeah. But what I like about this is all of these iconic shots and all these setup shots of showing how, I mean, it's brutal, but it's quick, and it's showing how he came from this brutal world and becomes who he is. It's amazing.
Well, what's interesting is they take the same form as around the wheel. So, in other words, he grew up around the wheel. Now he's growing up essentially in the gladiator ring.
Well,
actually a narrator who, what's one of the few times I've actually been able to accept any narration in most any film, and it works well.
Now, is this narrator a character in the
film? He is. He's I wish I could remember his real name. I forget him. You'd know him. He's a character actor. He just died a couple of years ago. But he's a Japanese actor who's been around forever, and he was in. I remember he was in The Big Brawl with Jackie Chan. He was Jackie Chan's teacher. But
is he a character in this film?
Yes, he shows up, and then here in a few, probably in about 20-30 minutes, he pops in.
Okay.
So this is like Gladiator, in a way.
Yeah, it
well,
does a lot.
Well, Gladiator is like this.
Yeah, Gladiator is like this. Yeah,
you live your life, then you're, you know, then you
yeah,
become
like,
a gladiator,
like Spartacus
and then,
or yeah. the classics.
And then you fight back, and then what happens after that? Only here he becomes a king.
Well, one thing could be said too. What I think makes this film work is so. I mean, all of these swords are real swords. They have real shields. Later, when they're swinging an axe or swinging a real axe, the broadsword he has is an actual real broadsword that probably weighs about 20 pounds.
Right.
But because so, it's Arnold, they can actually use
yeah,
it.
Yeah, and
can
it's like so many times in movies, you see these little Zac Efron little bastards swinging a sword, and it's like, yeah, oh yeah, you could do that, okay. But it, at the same time, it becomes meaningless. Whereas it adds weight and reality to it.
Right.
The
you can
film.
Even tell when they're forging the sword in the beginning that you're yeah. going to see real weapons.
Yes.
I forgot about this.
Speaking of real weapons.
That's for sure.
Aw.
But Conan's a gentleman.
He is a gentleman.
Well, he lays her down, but that's about as gentle as he gets.
Okay, he's modest. How about
yeah,
that?
Yeah, there you go. No, I understand. He knows how to work. He's a playboy.
Curtis, when you were talking about the swords, is there a lot of steel in this film? A lot of swords, a lot of shields, as you said, throughout the entire
everything
film?
Everything is real. Well, everything in this.
That makes me wonder if they were doing locations in Spain, because Toledo in Spain, which is like Toledo, if you were to spell it, that's where they made all the broadswords.
Really?
It was known as the steel capital.
Oh.
And I wonder if they used...
The steel capital for what?
For as far as all of Spain and all for that side of the world for all their steel and swords.
Wow.
I wonder
known
if that's
for that.
True.
And I'm wondering
like
it
if
is.
That's a connection.
When
well,
I visited
yeah, that,
Spain.
But for this.
But for this, I'm wondering if they just used all the stuff from there because over in Spain, that's where the real deal is.
I have not. Now, that building, looking at that, that looks like Spanish building.
Yes.
Yeah.
It really does.
This is a fantastic shot right here.
Oh, this is the yeah.
Oh,
this shot. Is famous.
It doesn't
shot,
hurt
yeah.
that Arnold was Mr. Universe well, and Olympia and everything else in the world, yeah. but look right here. It's an amazing shot.
And he knows how to handle
and look
a sword.
At that, right down the line of his part in his hair and his nose. Boom.
Nice
and
wipe.
Now,
I like that.
For those people that don't know, this saying that he's about to say, crush your enemies and all that stuff, is an actual, from literature, supposedly came from Genghis Khan. And Genghis Khan actually says what Conan says right here. So that's how thorough John Milius is in trying to be as true to history as you can. It's his own son.
And that would be his first line?
Yep,
first
line
in
the whole movie. Yeah. what a way to...
What did he say about the women?
Lamentation of the
lamentation
women.
Lamentation of the women, okay.
Lamentation
all right.
of the women, yes.
And tea and crumpets at 4.
But it's great, but it shows how driven you can be as well. I mean, you know, in war, you know, and that's what's great about John Milius. John Milius, you know, there is no way to win a war without violence. And that's so if you want to get political in modern day times, you know, there's no reason to be somewhere where we're not going to shed blood and do it with a purpose. So as you could see, like Vietnam and like our current situation, the world will be there forever.
Who knows? Who knows on that one? Yeah, Vietnam. Well, Vietnam, that was part of the problem was they didn't know how to get out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, you have to be a son of a bitch if you're going to win a war.
Well, it's interesting that basically, you know, Milius would use a story like this, a myth, to basically tell that kind of story. Mm-hmm. In other words, to tell modern story like that's much, much harder. And then it becomes all,
sure.
you know, oh, it could be this, could be that.
Sure.
Here. It's its own story.
Now, here's a funny little tidbit about this scene right here. These wild dogs, actually, when they were filming this, they actually catch up to him. And if you ever watch the DVD special features on this, they actually catch him and pull him back down the rock. And for those people that think that Arnold's, you know, yell where it's like he always does, when they catch him, they pull him down the rock. And it's hilarious because when they pull him down the rock, he kind of bounces down and goes in the bushes. And then you hear him from outside the bushes, underneath, you can't see him, and then you hear him go, God damn it! He just got drilled by these little dogs and just manhandled by them.
Now, did he just escape?
No, he fell down into this
No, before
cave.
That, he's running because he escaped?
The guy freed him.
He freed
yeah,
him.
With the axe.
Okay,
yeah,
that's what I thought. All right. So. Sorry, it's been a while.
But But right there, Arnold did his own stunt and fell down in there.
Well, that's good. And he finds...
And this is some fantastic cinematography in this cave right here.
Well, and it's beautiful set decoration.
The lighting is nice. It makes sense.
Oh, that's right. It's very motivated.
It's a lot of black. Looks good. It's not high-key lighting.
But here's another whole scene that takes place with almost no dialogue. It just...
Well, he's had just, one line of dialogue.
But this is the kind of role where it's actually so well-suited for him. I mean, the fact that this character even exists and they were going to make a movie and Arnold Schwarzenegger just happened to be...
Come around at the top.
Yeah, he was just kind of like bursting onto the scene. It's really fitting because he wasn't a great actor at this point in time. He didn't speak English very well, and it just happens to be completely motivated in this character that he wouldn't need to.
He wouldn't need to. He was illiterate. I mean,
he was raised, I mean, in a lot of ways, he is a lot like Conan.
Yeah. I mean, it was just so fantastical and stuff, and, you know, and, well, and he was unpolished, too. I mean, and whereas, if you know, they're in case people don't know, listening to this, they're making a Conan right now, and I believe they're almost done with production on it.
Oh, really?
Getting ready to go into post. And the guy they chose is actually a good choice visually for it, but he was on like a Baywatch Hawaii or something like that.
Oh,
so it'll be interesting if they're able to pull it off. And they'll be also interesting, is it going to be PG-13? Is it going to be rated R?
Right. If it's not rated R, I'm not going to
see
it.
Is there going to be? How's the director going to film it? I mean... But look at this skeleton. And then this
I was really excited that they were going to make a Red Sonja film, but that completely fell through
too.
Completely.
They were
going to
make a new Red Sonja film?
Yeah, they were going to. Robert Rodriguez was going to do it. I went to the panel and...
With Rose McGowan, that's right.
But they had all this conceptual art there with them, and because they hadn't really done much other than they've just put together all this artwork in order to get funding, and it was amazing, their concept for it, and the specific Red Sonja stories that they chose to put into the movie.
Would have been good.
It would have been great.
It would have been better than the Bridget Nielsen one?
it most likely would have been.
Well, this is interesting to point out. Well, one, the music is fantastic right here of him finding this sword. What is this called? The Atlantean Sword? Is that the name of the song?
I think that's the track title.
The Atlantean Sword. And this sword, eventually, at the end of this movie, is going to defeat his own dad's sword. And that's the one that shatters his dad's sword at the end. So it's kind of like this whole, as if this is meant to be, that he's supposed to find this powerful sword from the gods. Possibly this guy's a giant figure. He's not a normal man, that he gets it off of this skeleton. And then the reveal from the music alone, and then to have this, it's pretty interesting. It's a great piece.
Right. And part of the mythic structure is that the hero actually goes underground. Literally,
yeah,
and then actually,
this is a total Christ-like.
And actually, discovers their power and then reemerges.
True.
I mean, even if you look at Empire Strikes Back, Luke actually goes into the cave and sees Darth Vader.
True,
and then comes out. But you see that a lot. This. It's Arthurian legend and everything.
Great iconic shot again. But this is I totally hear you. And this is the same thing. He's coming back just like a Christ figure. Now he's born. All that other stuff was. All the build up to this point right here, and now he's Conan. This right here, plow, breaks it off. And what's great is that is a fantastic shot.
I like the shot of the dog. That was good.
A hero. But notice what he's wearing now.
Bearskins?
Dog skins.
The dog skins.
Oh, dog skins. There we go.
And I love little
points like that
don't need to be said, and they just kind of do it. Yeah.
It's cool.
Which is a lot of how this story is actually told.
Yeah,
that's nice.
Fucking John Milius, what happened to you, dude? Come on. I mean,
it's basically show don't tell.
He's got like five projects in the work.
This is a famous location.
Yeah, in Spain.
I've seen other films with this rock formation used in the past.
For those people who don't know, John Milius did Rome, all of that. So if you saw the TV series,
it's a fantastic show.
And once again, you want to talk about realism going back. They built all those sets in the middle of nowhere out in Europe. And it's the same thing. Practicality. And he derived all of those stories from real things happening. And they did the same here. And it has to be said that his co-writer on this, Oliver Stone, actually wrote the screenplay. And then him and Milius rewrote it together.
Mm.
But, you know, he's a war veteran. You know, the two of them together. Milius wasn't. Milius always wanted to be a war veteran, but never could because he got dishonorably discharged because of his asthma.
Dishonorably?
Or honorably discharged. He could never get in, actually. I don't think I should say that. But it's kind of interesting. So he's a military fanatic. So the two of them coming up with this, is that's where you get this brutality and the realism, I believe. I think I saw this whenever I was 10 or 11, and you can only imagine.
Yeah.
You could only imagine.
Yeah, I can only
imagine. As a boy.
Have you ever read the books?
I've read them vaguely. I was never a huge, huge fan of them.
I've read some of them. A few. I mean, I wouldn't be able to name every character in it, but I've read through some of them. I've actually read quite a few Red Sonja's when I was younger.
There's Red Sonja books?
Oh, yeah.
I'm actual books.
Oh, no, I'm talking about the comics.
Okay, I'm talking about the books.
Okay, I'm talking about the comics, which to me, comic book mean the same thing.
Yeah. Sorry. Okay, I will clarify. Novel. Did you read the Conan the Barbarian novels?
I never read the novels.
I read one. It's hard. Howard was a good writer, but, you know, it's hard for me to read anyway.
But the comics are great.
Yeah.
Okay.
And worth checking out. And the artwork in them is fantastic.
Was that Marvel or?
I'm not really sure.
No, it wasn't Marvel.
I think it was just some other. It was another publisher.
Okay.
I'm a bad comic book fan right now by not being able to remember that either.
I think Image has the right to it now, right. but they were not the originals.
Well, I mean, Frank Frazetta is the one that made Conan most successful because of the poster.
Is amazing.
But he actually drew one for this, like the German release. He just recreated one of the paintings he did, and I can't remember which one it was. It might have been one of his Death Dealers, but
I think Frazetta. Is it Frazetta that just passed away?
Yeah, he just passed away a couple months ago.
Oh, Frazetta was amazing.
I love that it's established he's a great lover, by the way. Conan, of his many talents.
Why wouldn't he be? Come on. I mean, all those years, he was bred to the finest stock. Weren't you listening? She'd never run into that, though.
Is she a demon?
Something like that,
I think she's a sorceress.
A witch?
She's a succubus.
Yeah, all of a sudden, I don't know. She's got a hair.
Now, allow her to have her orgasm in her own way. Don't judge.
Don't question.
This is really scary, though. This actually
scared you were how old? Seven?
Me very much.
Oh, and he burns her up.
That's why I was a virgin until I was 25.
Interestingly enough, they foreshadowed that when she took the powder and threw it in the fire, and it flamed up earlier in the scene. Yeah. I was like, maybe. Why'd she do that?
I noticed that. Now that you've pointed it out.
Yeah. And now he's... Okay, that's weird. Yeah, I think if I recall correctly, this basically started all the sword and sorcery movies of the
80s. It really was like one of the first ones.
When was the Beastmaster?
Love Beastmaster. Right.
That was after this.
Yeah.
Doesn't hold up as well as Conan.
No, it certainly doesn't, but I still love Kodo and Podo any day.
Yes. That's true.
That was Mark Singer.
He
right?
Little ferrets.
Yep. And he did like two or three of them, yeah.
Yeah. And here is the great reveal of Jerry Lopez. Jerry Lopez is a famous surfer. And this is his first ever acting role. And John Milius, why did he know him? Well, John Milius liked to surf. And so they did tons of casting for this. And he always had Jerry Lopez in mind when he was reading, because when he was writing for him, this guy would be like a Genghis Khan type of, you know, from that type of a tribe or something like that. And he just always thought of Jerry Lopez. And throughout all their casting, they couldn't find anybody. And then one time he just said, hey, Jerry, will you come in? And he read and
dude,
studio passed him.
You want to be in the film?
He's okay.
Sure.
And then, but even after they brought Jerry in, they couldn't find anybody. So it was even after that, they're like, well, I guess he's pretty good. He's good enough. And he's so athletic, and that's a great thing, is to show the athleticism of him and to be able to shoot those arrows the way he does. He's an athlete.
Right.
But that's another thing that makes this movie really seem tangible, is because there are a lot of actual athletes involved.
Yeah.
And structure-wise, what's interesting is now, you know, you've seen his whole journey of getting away. Now he's building the band, you know, getting the band together.
Mm-hmm. That's nice. It's on location. Look how lit they have him, but the sky looks nice behind him.
That is a very nice HMI shining in his face to make it, you know, make him stand out. But it is a very nice shot.
Right there.
Nice. Yeah. Wow.
Some bright firelight there.
But it's motivated.
It is. I like the fact that it's on location. I love that.
Spain looks really nice. Man, I'm thinking of all those other films. There was like Crawl. There was Legend.
Crawl doesn't hold up as well.
It's one of those. I don't know if that was on just
I love day. Legend.
You do?
Legend
does.
Fantastic film.
It holds up for a moment.
And I don't know. It's probably one of my favorite films.
Yeah, it's a great film.
And it has a lot of really well done practical effects, locations, the costumes.
Nice theme.
Yeah, this is a great.
Now, we saw this in Lord of the Rings, running across country for hours and days.
Yeah, look at that. Those are locations. See how I'm saying this is shot like a Western, you know? It's like going from when they're traveling from place to place.
Yep.
And this is like a real city.
That's in Spain,
Now, this is a Matt, I believe, the False of Doom thing.
The tower?
Yeah.
But it blends. See, that's the thing is if the best people who, best effects masters are ones who can combine something that is actually there, tangible, real, with a mat or with a CGI, and it looks so
flawless. Yeah.
It's flawless, perfect. You believe it.
I gotta say, there's a lot of dissolves.
It was really popular at that time. That type of editing. I mean, if you look at this, like the first Star Wars film, that was really posh.
There's a lot of dissolves here.
With this many dissolves, it gives the appearance of a lot of time passing when it wasn't.
So basically, because they're walking through the market, so basically this is all montage.
Hey,
okay, all right, I'll buy it.
Kurosawa can use dissolves, anybody. Not anybody.
Oh.
But Kurosawa
did
it.
It's like the zoom. You have to know when to use it.
And Milius is a huge fan of Kurosawa.
That's nice. That looks really nice. That architecture.
In sync. They're stepping in sync.
Yes, that's right.
Oh, except for when you got to kick the dog.
Kick the dog out of the way. And he's a sword expert.
It's in his blood.
We got to give a point for him to be able to flex his muscles here. And this is, I forget who it is. He's either a producer or somebody that was on set. He's like somebody on the crew. Or it might even be one of the producers or whatever, but they gave him a part.
Cool.
Because they didn't have a whole lot of dough for this movie. They did, but they didn't.
How much?
It doesn't look like it's low, low budget. I like the fact that it's looking better than it was, I'm sure, with the resources at hand.
Well, I mean, because if you look at Conan the Destroyer, they definitely did not have the budget they had here.
Oh, no, and those are definitely not all real swords.
Well, this lighting right here, I mean, as far as budget, it doesn't. Now, that's a floodlight right there. That's not too imaginative, but
the shots
before this are very nicely lit to have a much bigger budget look than I'm sure they had.
Uh-oh. Is this the shot coming up? Oh, come on. Oh.
Camel. Oh,
don't hit the camel. Oh. He hit the camel. Bad news. Dude.
Let's leave this place.
Yes, I hit the camel. I shouldn't have done that.
Well, see, like, the differences between this film and just Destroyer on its own, I mean, like, they're dressed like guys that are traveling across the plains or whatever they're doing, and they're carrying all their things. They're all on them. It's more of like, well, in Lord of the Rings, whenever, you know, like, Viggo Mortensen's character, he looked like he was weathered and warm, whereas in the Destroyer, it's Arnold with his shirt off. You know, it's like...
It's all the time.
It's like one of those things. It's like, why would he just be walking around with a loincloth in his shirt off? Where in this, he always has pants on, you know. I mean, it's like a guy traveling across the...
Do we know who directed Destroyer?
Do we care?
I'm curious.
I don't know.
I don't.
Okay, all right.
And this... what's her name again, this actress?
Sandahl Bergman.
Fantastic.
This was her big break.
She was a dancer, correct?
She was in the famous, what was the...
All That Jazz.
All That Jazz.
That's right.
What was it? Syphilis. what was that famous dance scene where they're all naked and they're doing that little thing and they're saying their names? She was a part of that.
So, yeah, she's a trained dancer.
Yeah.
Which, once again, transfers right over to the fact, I mean, a real trained dancer, not some, you know, I wish I were a trained dancer. I think I am 16 years old. But this is another thing, too. Nowadays, they'd cast some gorgeous woman who has, you know, no training and stuff like that, and then also doesn't look like the way she looks. She's a grown woman. She looks like right. She has life experiences.
And she looks like she can handle a sword.
Exactly. She looks
like
so
she would
So it's not
be
totally unbelievable yeah. when she does. You know, look at her legs.
Scarlett Johansson can handle a sword.
And apparently she can do backflips and, like, break someone's neck, too.
Exactly. It's just like
And she looks
things.
Good while doing it.
Yeah. The only thing I would laugh about is that they give her heels in this. You know, I'm like, oh, really, heels?
They also gave her a little feathered hairdo.
Yeah.
Conan was, also is rocking a little feathered hairdo.
It was
interesting.
It was 1980. Hey, dude, in 81, I had a feathered hairdo.
Well,
then again,
good.
Then
that's
again,
nice.
Then again, I had hair. So.
In this time frame, I don't know if it jives.
But I always love that in, you know, different eras when they're doing a period piece film, seeing how that different era interprets what that period would look like.
In the context of the hairstyles of when it was made. The film wise,
like, I greatly much enjoy any period film made in the 1960s. You get bright colors. Everybody's wearing some sort of beehive.
Or the right. westerns of the 50s guys got, like, you know pompadour hair and
a pink button down
yeah.
western shirt.
Well, makes perfect sense.
Well, this is leading up to that big musical track, right, Curtis? What the dang it.
The one of the best. The snake?
No, this, that's the orgy thing. What's it called?
The orgy is way later. Yeah, that's okay. Later in the film. But yes, the kitchen and the orgy is two tracks that are blended together on this score. But what's great to be notice about what's coming up is how fantastic the snake looks. And it's all practical. Half of it is practical where they built a large snake. And the other half is a miniature version of it that they play to the with a forced perspective, but it looks absolutely fantastic.
May I point out that the producer of this film is also the same producer that did Flash Gordon, the Sam J. Jones in the 80s. He did the remake of King Kong in 1976. We're talking Dino De Laurentiis.
Oh, that's right, baby. De Laurentiis.
I did notice that in the beginning.
Right. The shot, the establishing shot that was just a few frames ago of everyone kneeling, and the set looked very Flash Gordon-esque to me. Oh. I said, that's right, Dino De Laurentiis did this film.
The Mings.
Yeah, Ming the Merciless should pop out any second right now.
But even like this music is fitting for this here. Like that is a forced perspective snake.
I mean, what I like about this is that, I mean, you don't see films like this often that successfully take you into a world like this, and then you feel like, you know, I mean, this is a world full of danger, full of some very crazy crap.
Well,
and
go ahead.
I mean, I think it's a tough job. that was good. I like that. Well, and then Sandal Bergman's
well,
there.
I think part of the success of that, if I might jump in, is the same reason why I think Star Wars was successful and the later Star Wars weren't, because we got to see everything in the newest ones. But in the old one, yeah, they fed you a lot of the imagery and everything, but they also let your imagination do the work. In
well,
this,
because there were certain limitations.
Yeah.
Because they were trying to do it. Right. They were trying to actually do this.
Yeah, and they had to. But it works as a story because your imagination is more powerful than anything they're going to be able to draw up for you.
But it's also the world. I mean, essentially, in a way, it's the world building. That is exactly it. The world building in Star Wars was excellent. And here, I think, more than most any other sword and sorcery film, they managed to build this world really well.
The environment is very fleshed out.
Yeah. But at the same time, they also don't beat you over the head with it.
Well,
so
that's
they,
the point,
they make it.
It's show, don't tell.
Very good directing.
Oh, and the snake.
I always love that. That was great. An amazing shot, just showing the sweat go off and then pop.
Yeah, this set right here has very Italian feel to me.
Oh.
Dino De Laurentiis, Italian influence, the way the set looks.
Italian.
Like an Italian illustrator, Italian set designer did this. Sequence. It just has that feel to me.
Hey, Curtis, can you hand me the DVD case? Thank you.
That's what reminded me of Flash Gordon, because of that.
Yep. And see, like, right up until this point, I think kind of Arnold was kind of losing what his motivation was, like what his purpose was. And then he
was just
wandering. And then now he's like, ooh, it just reawakened him to that original desire. See, like, that's forced perspective.
But it looks so good.
It's great.
Really? That looked full scale to me.
No,
looked like that one.
Whoa.
Looked like the back of that.
I mean, even
the large one.
Let me tell you, even for puppetry,
that's
some great puppeteering right there.
Well, the late 70s into the 80s were the best times for puppetry. And then, you know, it all died off after poor Jim Henson passed away.
Yeah, when was Dark Crystal? That was like 80.
It was 84, 85
ish.
Yeah, but this is a great sequence. And then for him shooting, now they really shot those arrows. John Milius shot that arrow into the snake, by the way. He was off camera.
Good shot.
Shooting that in there.
That's a hands-on director.
Yeah.
That's right.
But I love how he when he hits him, watch the steam. See it steaming off of
him?
It's kind of like, the heat of the blood. It makes it so real.
And just imagine if that snake would have been CGI. And, you know, then you watch it a decade later and it looks so dated.
Yeah,
good point.
God, it's I'm so mad that I can't remember this guy's name. He's the lineman for the Oakland Raiders. Famous during the days of the Oakland Raiders' total domination of the NFL.
I like how the music changes.
it gets
all jaunty.
Dun, dun, dun. Yeah, I know when I climb rope, I can climb it that quick.
Yeah, so can I. Ooh, nice.
But it shows how good of an improviser she is and is able to just zip.
Yeah.
But once again, believable. Not overly done.
Just enough.
Just enough.
It's the old...
I mean, you got
to
have some.
Get them to
flash,
go down so you can
go
up.
It was a little James Bond-ish, but it was fine.
It was James Bond, Indiana Jones, but Indy came after this.
She's crazy.
Whoa. That line was in Starship Troopers. Do you want to live forever?
Well, they stole it from this.
And also scored by Basil Poledouris.
I was going to say.
Coincidence?
Maybe. I think not.
Maybe not.
Well, I think John Milius, what is it, one quote I wrote down that he said? He said, I've led a whole life behind enemy lines. I've been the victim of so much persecution. I'm the barbarian of Hollywood. Because of his sensibilities and the way... I was reading an article just recently that was actually written in 2007, but it's about a 16-page article on the internet, on IGN.net, of him just... He pulls no punches. He's busting Lucas's balls. He's busting Spielberg's balls as to why some of their movies weren't successes. And even down to Saving Private Ryan, he was asked to come into Saving Private Ryan and rewrite some of it. And he said, I can't do anything. This is totally unbelievable. There's no, you've given these guys no purpose other than the fact that he's had two brothers killed as to why whereas he wanted to come in and make it an actual military story and give purpose as to why they would actually be coming after this one guy, but he said, I don't have the time to do it because you're already in production. Right. And I can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But he tells it the way it is, and he tells you why it's not or why it wasn't as good as it could. And he basically flat out says, it was horribly written. And in Lucas's case, he comes out and says, Lucas was never a writer. Ooh. And then he talks about the new ones. They were underwritten, but he had an idea and he wanted to do it, and that's the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's why he's not had the career he.
Well, I'm sure that could affect it. I mean, all of those people you just mentioned have had huge influences in what Hollywood is today, modern day, mm-hmm. you know, industry. So,
what was another quote? He said, most Hollywood scripts made today are garbage, Milius said. Written by broken writers with no shame. There is no shame in the world, and without shame, you cannot have honor. Our world is ruled by consensus now. There is no sense of honor.
Does this guy hang out with the... writer. What's the guy, the writer that you always mention? The one who is not the favorite of...
No, I know you're talking about it. I'll think of it in a second.
I have to mention that while we're talking about this, there is a love scene going on screen.
Yeah, well,
but that's an 18... what is that? I was 18 or 19 when I saw this. Like, okay, I appreciated this at the time.
It can be said that she does look great naked. That helps with the dancer body.
Well, it served its purpose. I mean, it shows their growing relationship.
But it also shows... It shows because he's had two other love scenes prior to this, and in both times they go by really, really fast. In both times, he's the dominant figure.
And
in them.
They're not intimate.
And here he's and here they're basically equals.
Right.
What it shows me is just zero body fat. Am I the only one that wants to start running, do some cardio right now?
I had a huge crush on her whenever I was younger. Eesh. So,
and fade out.
But what I like is how the movie's taken its time. It's not rushing from sequence to sequence. It's letting everything play out.
Yeah.
And here in a second, we're going to get, well, speaking of Flash Gordon.
Sam Jones?
No, Ming. Is it
but Mike's von Sydow.
He's
Mike's
in this?
Mike's von Sydow's playing the king here in just a minute.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, wow, that's no coincidence.
And
he's
fantastic. He
had a contract with Dino De Laurentiis, obviously.
Well, he also liked to work, and he was a good actor.
Yeah.
But actually, getting back to what you were saying, the interesting thing is that how the confidence in the story, how it's being told, doesn't have to basically keep on, you know, we don't have to keep on cutting back to what's Thulsa Doom doing now, which kind of drives me crazy. We have to let the other, we have to know what's happening with otherwise. Oh, this is a great shot.
For anybody that cares, if you want to listen to the commentary on the special edition that we have anyway, it's a fantastic commentary with Arnold and John Milius, but Arnold is so hilarious in the sense of he takes himself so he literally is doing commentary and he's saying, look right here, look what I'm doing. Look at it's like the guy. He's basically commentating on himself. He's not commentating on the movie. He's like, it is hilarious to hear the commentary of he's speaking in third person, basically. It's hilarious.
And it gives you the impression there's some ego involved.
He's speaking as if he's Conan. Yeah, it's so funny. It's, you know, but to do it in his dialect. Here's Max.
Is that Max?
Yeah.
I love it when he bring in Jerry Lopez and the way the way Max reads this line. Listen.
Awesome. And what's nice also is the sense of humor in this film.
Yeah.
I mean, there is some humor, but it's not a
it's
lot.
It's not overkill.
But it's not overkill, and it has its voice, which is nice. It's like back in Raiders.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Raiders
did
the same thing. It has its own good
talking about
voice,
it,
doesn't overdo
you think,
it.
You think he's ever done Shakespeare? I mean, the way he reads these lines.
Mm-hmm.
He's so regal, and it's so, well, obviously, but perfect.
He's a phenomenal actor.
Yeah.
But right here, when he says, and when he's talking about his daughter, and he says, and his, and the way he says his is just, eesh. Thieves. What a great reading.
Yeah. And what's great is that, I mean, right now we're basically, I'm going to guess at about the, we're about at the midpoint. I think
we're
about 55 minutes in, and I mean, this basically is going to send them on to
the mission.
The mission now. Exactly.
It's got to be pretty cool to be surfing one day, the next day standing in front of Max von Sydow doing a movie.
Jerry Lopez being as good a surfer as he is, probably didn't care. He's like, who? I don't know.
Dude. He looks a little like Santa Claus.
He actually does a little bit in that attire.
Look at the hat and the beard and everything. Do you think that was intentional? Look at that. And what's nice about this is it shows that, you know, Thulsa Doom doesn't rule the entire world and that there are people who can actually have enough power that can challenge him.
See how he's hitting every syllable?
Yeah, well, he's a very classically trained actor. Yeah.
And he's doing it so well.
He's doing the Peter O'Toole stuff in this film.
Yikes, that's a lot of jewels. So the mission is to rescue someone?
To rescue the king's daughter.
Okay.
Oh. A great written line.
That is nice.
Yeah. It is.
It's a well-written line.
And he delivers it excellently. You can see it in his eyes.
He meant what he was saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does he show up anywhere else in the film?
Nope.
Oh, well, no,
by Max.
Probably at the end.
No, they shot some scenes with him, but they ended up not in the film.
Okay, well, that makes sense. I mean, he came in, he did the scene, it's important. You know, this is what it is. He has his place, and yeah.
I believe in the original, I think it's on the special features of this disc, that he ends up getting killed by his own men. Come in and kill him. And
whoa.
Do a little Julius Caesar on him.
That's a bit of a downer.
Yeah, I'm glad that's not in the movie.
Yeah, really. This version makes me feel night better.
I like how bright that candle is.
It is, and how it's hitting the wall.
I do think there's some sequence or something that reflects in the background, so I think it's justified.
Yeah.
No, I didn't mean, I was honest, I do like how bright, because that's the light source, and it should be that bright in comparison to everything else.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I like.
No, what I was saying is how
they bounced it off
and highlighted. I mean, obviously, they pointed an instrument there to emphasize it as compared to the left side of the screen.
And the shadow on his chest is just right for where the candle is.
I think this DP did a good job.
I mean, to give a little credit where credit is due, you look at Arnold in these scenes, yeah, he's not saying a whole lot, but those are tough scenes, and he's getting great reactions over there, and there is one thing to say about him over some of the modern muscle-bound guys. Like, my personal opinion, I can't stand to watch The Rock unless he's doing a comedy. Mm-hmm. Well, whenever he has to play serious action roles, whatever, I'm like, you know, they're very cartoony, very character-y, kind of joking. And if you even look at movies like The Scorpion King, you know, it's like, to me, that is don't work. I mean,
besides the fact
the film was a bad film, but him in it, I just didn't buy him. Is that I just can't see The Rock even doing this.
Well, I'm going to refer to a film you'd never think I'd refer to as Batman and Robin. Hang on. I'll get to it. The point in a second is the thing is that he plays vulnerability very well. And in Batman and Robin, there is that one, there's like a scene where he plays really, really vulnerable.
He's talking about his wife.
Yeah. And that was the one part that was like, and it was really excellent. I was like, wow, that was very good.
I heard some commentary or some article I was reading not too long ago that said just that. They're like, yeah, that film is a bad film and whatever, and it's kind of goofy, and there's some great there were some horrible one-liners in that, but they said that he does a lot of good work in that film.
Yes.
And if you do,
except he's covered in possibly like one of the worst costumes ever.
Oh, that costume is great.
But this is a good character point right here where they're actually showing that he's having to make a choice. Do I need to stand up for everything I believe in, or go and it's a great choice. I mean, well, it's a great predicament he has to pull himself out of. Like, what do I do? One or the other.
Right.
Do I live for all of my morals, or do I stay and live the high life?
I like his costume there. It looks it looks kind of Asian.
It's very Genghis Khan.
Yeah.
So what do you think there, Tim? Very Western-y there?
Oh. I was thinking how much this needs a Blu-ray release.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not out on Blu-ray?
No.
What the heck?
See, look at the framings. Mm-hmm. Look at the way they frame so much of this movie. It's very well done.
So now what's he doing? He's looking
for
what?
Decided to go on his own to rescue the girl.
And because, not take the others with him?
Yeah, because he wanted to get his revenge on Falsa Doom because they kidnapped his the daughter.
Right. But he doesn't want the others to die, basically.
Well, yeah, partly he's protecting them, but at the same time, they didn't want to go. They were like, hey.
Yeah, they didn't really want to go.
Got it.
And he has a real purpose.
Yeah, they have no purpose.
They have no purpose other than, you know, for some money or to protect their lives, maybe.
But they were already rich.
Yeah, but they were already rich. And I'm sure, you know, as thieves, they could weasel themselves out of any situation.
Okay. All right.
See a lot of the shots they show Arnold in there. You know, the camera's underneath, rides above, very iconically filmed.
Nice crane shot. Basil's going to town. Well, I like the ocean there. That's great.
And he rides a horse very well.
Yeah.
Yeah, he actually does. Another thing that bugs me in film.
Spain looks really, really good. It does. Look at that.
Now he's laughing at people who can't ride horses when they're supposed to in films.
Oh, I was just today. I was flipping through channels, and on one of the cable channels, they had what was the Texas Rangers with the kid from Friday Night Lights? The or not Friday Night Lights? The heck was it? But anyway, a few of the guys I do know. Who's the guy that
Vanderbeek?
Vanderbeek.
James Vanderbeek.
Oh boy,
Dawson's Creek. Yeah,
whoo! Some of the horse riding in that. I was like, eesh.
What was this?
Texas Rangers. It was a Western that came out in like 2001.
It came and it went.
Oof. Oh, I must have missed that. Yeah. Shucks.
Yeah, no, you didn't. It had Usher as a cowboy and a Texas Ranger, and it had, who's Demi Moore's husband?
Ashton Kutcher.
That's all you need to know.
What is this place?
Well, this is a great, once again, going back to practical sets, it's a fantastic set. And John Milius, I think I heard him explain it one time, that it was a place where people worship the gods and whatever. And obviously, it's they get the idea from the famous...
Okay, I got it.
Stonehenge.
Yeah,
and so basically they take the skeletons and they... Basically,
and here's your narrator.
That's what's his name?
I always forget his name.
Oh, it's on the tip of my tongue. Oh, it starts with a K.
Yeah, he's a great actor.
I'm embarrassed.
I think he was in one of the famous Japanese films where he actually played the one of the generals that was in that. Bombed Pearl Harbor or something like that. What's the, not the new one, not the Michael Bay film, but...
You mean...
Tora Tora? I think he was in Tora Tora Tora. I might be totally wrong.
It's like one name. Starts with a K. Yeah, starts with K.
That's a beautiful shot.
That's a surfer shot. Yeah. Someone who likes to surf likes that shot.
I think he was on MASH.
The series or the film?
The series. I think every Asian actor
got work on MASH at some point.
MASH in the 70s, yeah.
See how well-framed this shot is, though? I mean...
I like how the fire and the embers are flying.
Yeah, I do like that. And how clear they are.
But once again, it's a master shot. They're just holding it. They don't... You're not getting like a two-shot going back and forth. I mean, now you're getting one, but it's not overwrought with it.
No, it's really well edited.
Okay, there was a K in it. Of course, I could have just looked at the cover once again. It's called Mako.
Mako, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Perfect name for a pop star. I wonder if he sang.
Mako?
Yeah.
Oil the sword. See, that's what's great about John Milius. I love little details like that. A lot of people don't know that the sword, a real steel sword, will rust or will ruin the sword if you don't take care of it. And somebody like John Milius just throws that in there.
I like how they, you know, there's his softer side. He's bringing flowers, you know. That's what makes this film a little different.
And I think that's all kind of established in the very, very beginning with his mother.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, and then just all throughout it's just strung along.
Now, who are these guys?
Hippies. It's a love-in.
Clearly.
Thank you.
Well, John Milius was a child of the 60s, so hey, he's okay.
They had some overcast weather.
Very nice. And very nice to shoot in. And still, what's interesting is, you know, these hippies, so to speak, I mean, it's recognizable, kind of, but it still feels foreign.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's just establishing another different type of people that live in this, like, nomadic culture.
Yeah, actually, you know what? I think that's what it is. It's all nomadic.
Now, that's where our full scale.
I think that's what's kind of thrown me off is like, all of this is nomadic, which is essentially ancient cultures, ancient civilizations.
Which makes it feel very ancient, biblical,
otherworldly, because as far as, you know, everything we know is essentially
structure,
essentially agrarian, urban.
Excellent costumes.
Yeah.
I love how, you know it's a really good fantasy film when it doesn't feel so fantastical. And I feel that way about, like, the costumes. Like, those look like those could be robes worn by an actual religion. Or, you know, it almost seems like something familiar. I've seen this before.
Well, that was my point about, you know, the idea of the hippies, is they, it seemed familiar but not familiar. So it was not so far out there, where I think a lot of the problem with the sword and sorcery films is they went so far. We have to get so fantastic and show magical powers. I mean, there is barely any magic, so to speak, that plays in this world.
But we know it exists.
Yeah.
I think that evil sorceress chick was as much magic as we've seen so far, don't you think?
I think it's about as much magic as we get.
I think there's more when he finally is confronting his ultimate foes.
Right.
But it is. It's that kind of, it gives you the idea that this is the kind of world where that does exist, where that can happen. You know, if you're tapped into it, but it doesn't have to knock you over the head and say, you know, there's magic.
And at the same time, it doesn't feel like 1981, though we know it was shot, you know, basically released in 1981, but it doesn't, you know, it doesn't stink of it.
No.
And that is our full scale set in the background, correct?
Really?
I mean, under that hill, that's the huge fortress area.
On the hillside?
Yeah, isn't it? That huge big fortress back there.
Wow. I think it's either, I couldn't tell what I thought it was.
I think that's where the film winds up. That's where
it's going.
Is built.
Yeah. Okay.
It looks,
I couldn't tell if it was
me.
A monument or if it was an actual fortress.
We'll have to ask Curtis.
Curtis?
What?
The back there on the back of the hill?
Yes.
That's an actual full size set, right?
That's where the film winds up, isn't it? Where
I do believe, yeah. As far as I remember anything I've read about it and everything else, yeah. So, but the, yeah, all the makings of, I think I remember them saying that they built all that.
Okay, so these, okay, we call them the hippies.
Yeah,
those are
there
the,
it is.
Those are the disciples. That's related to what we saw in the temple. Okay, now I'm saying,
right, yeah,
like, the same people who were in the temple that were offering themselves up
to
sacrifices.
Yeah, you see all the snakes that are on their, what would you call that, their habits?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean,
they should sing, how do you solve a problem like Maria?
See, look at that set.
Holy simoleons, that's nice. It's better than Stargate.
And I love the uniforms of these, the guards and stuff. They're really neat looking.
Yeah.
I remember I always liked this set. The first time I saw this movie, I was like, hey, they went all out. Good for them.
I like those masks on the warriors.
Yeah.
Look at that. That is badass.
Well, I mean, Basil Poledaris right here is going to town. One of my favorite pieces of the whole score right here. And I think this is The False of Doom is the name of the title, I think, track.
So you would say this is your favorite Poledaris score?
By far.
That's a lot of extras back there.
Well, it's the first one I've really listened to where I can listen to it all the way through without having to, you know, it's like, that isn't fitting. It's, to me anyway, I can listen to it without the movie.
And every track is something you like.
I like, yeah.
When they were walking all in a line on the switchbacks, that's where it showed you all the extras.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of people.
Oh, no, was
great. Yeah, so many people.
That's, I'm going to guess, probably 1,000.
A lot
of
people.
Which is a lot.
Costuming?
That's a big call.
Costuming?
That's a big call. You know, the biggest call I ever went on when I did my extra days was, I think, 500. And that was a big call.
What do you do with all those people?
Well, right here,
you have to clothe them. You have to feed them. You got to set up bathrooms for them.
Hurry up and wait for 1,000 people.
Good times, let me tell you.
Yeah, I would not want to be the extras wrangler on such a project.
Out in the middle of nowhere in Spain.
Oh, there were several of them, that's for sure. Lots of bullhorns.
I mean, like right here, what do you do without this piece with Basil doing this stuff? Well, I mean, you know, this is probably a good point to bring up the fact that the concert you got me, Tim, where the
Basil Poledouris performs
they
live
him
in
back
concert.
To Spain, live in concert.
His last concert.
Nice. His last concert before he died.
Oh, mm-hmm. Wow.
Go ahead, Tim.
It's the full, well, it's, I don't know if it's the full score, it's highlights of his Conan score with an orchestra and choir. And it's so, wasn't it? It's just wonderful to watch him conduct live.
Well,
because
he never conducted a lot of, for those that don't know, people like John Williams or other famous film composers will go out around. Like I've seen John Williams many times at the Hollywood Bowl performing and conducting their music in concert. Well, Basil never did that. And that was the first time that he ever did it?
I think the first time conducting a full orchestra for an audience, I think.
Oh, these costumes are amazing right now.
No, you're right. They are.
Amazing. Oh. And also the priestess girl that just came out as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. But the whole scene, this whole setup to this moment has been like, what, 4 or 5 minutes?
Or more.
Just to Thulsa Doom's entrance. And, of course, the whole thing with Arnold and...
Well, even
sneaking
the
up on
robes
it. But,
the,
but even writing-wise, it was really nice. You have this whole thing where basically Thulsa Doom greets everyone, and it's all tied together with the fact that Arnold is trying to... Well, essentially, Conan's trying to get in.
Right.
And that's some good writing and directing.
But and it's great in writing too, because of course, like the time he decides to infiltrate, there's already this great big gathering happening. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just the timing of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's the daughter of the king.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
She's
the daughter.
Wow.
Yeah.
And she's fallen under a spell.
Yeah.
Got it.
For a film that would have any budget limitations or something, I am just impressed at how full out they went for this.
I can't tell there's budget limitations.
Production. Exactly. You can't, and that's wonderful.
Way. Nice rock formations.
Speaking of Arnold films, he's in almost every Arnold film. That guy that was stepping on his hand right there. He was in The Running Man. He's the one that is like the main security guard for the host of the show. And he's like, it must be the steroids at the end. He's
See,
look at this shot right here. Great shot.
Oh, Jones's performance is actually really awesome in this.
Well, he's a theater-trained actor. He's amazing. Yeah. And this is great setup for his character. I mean, he even talks. I mean, just with a little bit of writing, and that's why it makes it such fantastic writing, is that you realize that at one point he was just some youthful guy that was running around just killing people for war and power, and that's what he thought it was. But then he finds out that true power is in the minds of human beings, and if you can control them, then you don't need to have the strength of war. You can just control their minds. It's quite great writing.
Now, does Thulsa know who this is?
He does here, and he's going to tell him right here. He doesn't particularly know who he is, but he does know what he did. Hey there, right there.
Oh, I like that sigh.
But this is where the writing comes in. It's great. Is a great reaction.
Mm.
Great stunt.
Yeah, it was
great.
A great stunt.
Great stunt. One shot. Everybody in frame.
What a great villain.
Is that not great writing?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, whoa. but that is unbelievable. So now he has to swallow the fact that all of this time he had the wrong idea. It's great.
The wrong idea being?
Well, I mean, he's right for wanting to avenge his family and everything, right. But he had the total wrong idea of what is strength and power, and he knew nothing of life, really. And not that James Earl Jones' character's figured it out, but he knows what true... Well, he's a politician. He knows how to control people. When you can control people, doesn't matter that you if you have a couple of missiles or a big giant sword.
Well, what I'm seeing in this is James Earl Jones said, I made you who you are.
Sure.
The strength you have came from me. So look to me for being your identity.
Yeah.
Right.
But yeah. Schwarzenegger, it's not in the fact of who has the power. It's what you plan to do with it. I mean, your intent. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So
right.
James Earl Jones is going to take the power that's around him and the strength to use it for evil. Schwarzenegger, even though he is reacting because of what James Earl Jones did to him, and so he has to become powerful to react to it, is going to use it for good.
Yes.
Which is what makes Conan different than Thulsa.
Even right.
And he's younger, he's learning the lessons, but he
But
will
it's
use
also
it for
what makes
reason.
Conan different than every other character in this film.
Yeah.
You know, right. Everybody else right. is motivated by something dark, something, yeah. even if it's just greed.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else is motivated by lust or greed or mm-hmm. power, and he's the only one who has like a true motivation.
Right,
he's hell bent on justice, but justice from the perspective of what your values being good.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know. So. That's what I'm saying.
You know, you're right exactly, and Thulsa Doom gave him that. He's basically his father for his. Determination and will.
The catalyst
yes.
to bring him to this point, but he's not going to use it for to become the ends of what James Earl Jones is doing. So I'm all for the power, it's just what you do with it.
Right, and what, I mean, what basically Thulsa...
This
you
is...
Know,
sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, this is always my favorite part of any great story is when you think that the hero is completely doomed.
Yeah.
And then something happens.
Yeah,
that's right.
It's fantastic.
And need we even mention the Christ-like symbolism there?
Yeah, we got that.
Okay. I'm just thinking of the evil Keebler elves that have to be living in that tree.
It does look like the Keebler elves.
Twisted elves.
And now we're talking about goodness, and now we have basically, well, it looks like both of them have joined them because they said, we'll essentially join you on your quest because we won't stick with what we know already. We will go to what we don't know and follow you because it's worth it.
They're forever changed.
And Mako.
Well, it's essentially why Conan has power. He eventually becomes a king is because this is why people follow him. They see his motivation and
because
they're drawn to him.
Because he respects them. You know, he respected these two individuals. He helped them. Mm-hmm. And now they're back to help him. He helped them with good intention, and now they're back to return that favor. And that's why he's surviving. He's surviving
sure.
because of his good intentions he put out.
Yes.
You reap what you sow.
Right. Yeah.
His mission is true. Now,
who's doing the motorboat impression?
That's Mako.
That's Mako.
Now,
on.
That's Sumerian, that they're Sumerian characters, correct?
I don't know that.
I think it is. I mean, I think I've read before that it was. Essentially, Sumer being the most ancient known civilization.
I like that. Dusk.
Back before the
again.
Internet. Yeah. Oh, yeah. They had like half an hour to shoot this. Maybe 45 minutes.
I'm sure it's blue screen.
No, there's just been one blue screen shot or sequence.
The
they're not even
the
in
beginning.
Spain.
Yeah. And that's
they're on a
Malibu
set,
Beach.
City.
Well, you know, frankly, probably yeah. But I'd like to think it's Spain.
See, like the actress there, another great shot. Hey,
another surfer
that's
shot.
That's yeah. actually a very nice ocean shot.
Very
it's really
telephoto.
Nice to think they could actually get
that
know,
was
get
a,
the water.
Like a 200 millimeter lens, almost.
But I mean, like you have these amateur actors in her. She'd really never acted before this, and Jerry Lopez, and Arnold at the time really hadn't done a whole lot, and even the Oakland Raiders guy, and then all these people in this movie that had never acted yet. It's a well directed, well acted film because you give them purpose, and you have fantastic writing. If you have great writing,
so is here the idea that they're basically tapping into mystical powers to bring Conan back from the verge of death.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
And the gods are doing their thing.
And then they're doing, there it is. Okay.
And
because
she's
blessed by the gods.
Talk about the magic. So here we go.
She's giving up her soul to save him.
Oh, she is?
So later when she perishes, it's her payment to the gods.
Okay. Oh, wait, these are evil? They're trying to grab him? And they're
Oh.
Yeah. Well, because they opened up a channel. And anything can come through.
Oh, look at that animation. Yeah. Wow. That's cool. That's
and it holds up.
Yeah, it still does.
On.
Yeah.
That's creepy.
This is getting into more of the
I like that.
Robert E. Howard stuff and the comic book legend of it. You know, where it's, you know, they don't focus a whole lot on the mysticism and everything during the rest of the movie, but during this part, this is where it kind of.
Reminds me a bit of Ghost.
Oh yeah,
the demons and Ghost.
That's right.
It does actually a little bit.
Yeah, which I guess was about 5 or 6 years later.
Oh my gosh.
I'm just reading information on the standard def disc. It's in mono sound. Wow. This should be 5.1 stereo, man.
At least.
No!
For those people out there listening, Tim is a sound aficionado.
No, I'm just, with this score,
somebody drinking fine wine, he shakes it and stirs it, before he sniffs it before he actually listens.
But...
It's all about the palate, baby.
This is Conan, man. Conan should
be.
Yeah,
it should. Well, this with
this
score
in mono, give me a break.
Well, maybe that's what they're doing for Blu-ray. They're getting it ready.
Let's hope.
I can only hope.
They've been cooking
it up. Nice little remastering. And
if we actually knew that studio heads actually cared that much about the product, what they put out, which is why we've talked many times, me and Tim, about the palate of the people in Europe, and that's why they get a lot of the film versions that we don't get over here because they actually give two shits. If anybody wants to check out other stuff Basil has done, Lonesome Dove is a great score.
And talk about Westerns, Westerns influence.
Quigley Down Under,
great
score. I mean,
he did Quigley?
Quigley Down Under, yeah.
Oh, cool. Hunt for Red October.
Hunt for Red October. By the way, another
choral piece.
John Milius wrote.
You know,
Hunt for Red October.
I just think of RoboCop and
Starship Troopers.
Starship Troopers. He did Total Recall too, right?
I don't think he did. I don't
think he did Total Recall.
No, that's Jerry Goldsmith.
Yeah, there you go.
I knew you were going to say that. Wait, it's Rachel Portman.
No, it's Jerry Goldsmith.
Okay.
This is a great reawakening moment.
Yeah.
Yes.
Played all out with music and once again with no dialogue. And it doesn't hurt that he actually knew how to pose and Arnold swinging your freaking 24-inch.
And of course,
biceps.
Symbolically, what's he done? He was basically crucified.
I love that he handled it. Like
and
he's
essentially almost died, and he's now back again. Now, I mean, we're going through all the mythic paces here.
Yeah. And now see that sword. I mean, that is a heavy damn sword.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's the great thing that makes it work.
Right.
And then later in their fight sequences, it really works because they're not running around like ninjas jumping off things and spinning and kicking, and they're swinging them. And they're
That's why you can tell how strong he is because he's handling a humongous broadsword like a katana right there.
Yeah, exactly.
Like any regular person, you'd have to put your entire body weight to even get that over your head.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's good.
Do we know why, where he got the spindle necklace? Is that, did he always have that wheel when he was a child that he wears?
No, they that came about from that wheel of pain, I believe. They gave it to him, and he was wearing it at the beginning while he was, it was after his first fight, he kind of got it. And I think that was kind of like a symbol of his being a champion or something.
Oh,
like
yeah,
that.
Okay.
I mean, but they never really identify it as to how he got it. It just kind of appears.
Right, because I've noticed he's been wearing it the whole time, and that it kind of like ties into a lot of things that have happened in his past. I just couldn't recall when he got it.
But it shows up right after that point. Once again, a great shot. Split diopter?
No.
Just able to have a long lens and...
Yeah,
but once again,
I don't think
great
that
shot,
split.
Though. Is it?
Nice.
I mean, both of them are
nice placement
right in there.
Nice placement. And that's I also awesome. Just like the fact it's so much location work.
Yeah.
That's where you get your environment from. That's where you get reality. That's where you get, you are there. It's your, you know, you can breathe, taste, touch. You're in this place because it's all locations.
Yep.
Well, wonder, they didn't have to do that. It's really cool that they went to the trouble to do this.
Yeah.
I love that.
And see, that's an old Western trick right there to show the horse's hooves and the lower part of their bodies to show the traveling of distances. And that was an old John Ford and other Western directors' tricks they would do. And it just makes you feel like they've traveled. So it's not like they just rode over the hill and now they're at the Falls of Doom. But I like how this whole buildup, they don't boom in with Basil's score. All of this is just the chanting of those little drums in the back.
Yep.
Dun, 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 until they do the orgy sequence here.
That's good breathing
kitchen.
Because it's not overkill
where
you don't appreciate the music because it's always going full tilt.
Yeah.
If you give some breathing, then it's when not, it kicks in, you're like,
exactly.
Yeah, baby.
So here in a second, whenever Jerry Lopez does the first blow and just swipes this guy, it works. But this is great orchestral stuff right here. It's
yeah.
Unbelievable. And what the hell is it? It's like they're having an orgy and they're eating people. It's like they're cannibals. What the hell? It's great. It's so a Jim Jones moment of drinking the Kool-Aid, right?
Yikes.
Yeah, you see, seeing this for the first time, I was like, what the hell is going on? That's when it was getting, you know, kind of.
But it really prepared me for Temple of Doom, you know. Then I could handle that a little bit more.
They stole the lighting in Temple of Doom from this.
Yeah, it's very similar.
Anyone who likes.
For me, Temple of Doom was. Well, I mean, in terms of the gore, that was like gore for fun. Here, this was like gore. I mean, I understand there's a purpose for the gore, but it, in a way, I guess my point is it shows like the violation of what you consider to be humane. I mean, cannibalism is, you know, it is just wrong. Here, this society has adopted it as a way, as part of what it is, and just saying how wrong and bad and evil it is.
Right.
And so they're showing, and I mean, they're showing that. I mean,
Well, it's certainly a setup for a reason as to why the audience doesn't care that they're about to hack these people up themselves because
yep.
like,
exactly.
these gross sons of bitches.
This is some really gross shit.
Just give us some justified violence. Thank
Sir,
you.
Did you see in the background? There was Charlton Heston. He was following an assembly line. He was looking for something. What was that all about?
I don't know. I think he'll find out in a couple thousand years.
Tim, you were about to make a comment after the Indiana Jones
Just
concert.
The music. Anyone who likes this music really needs to listen to Carmina Burana, which is Carl Orff from the, 40 or something.
Oh, no, it's much more modern.
Was it?
Yes.
What year was it done?
I don't know, but I think it's like either turn of the century or early 20th century. Yeah.
Because it's all lifted from that. Ooh, Sandel Bergman
and
slipped.
Another,
did you see that? She slipped in that shot.
And this is not a language, right? They're kind of doing
chanting.
Yeah,
it's just weird. Just a make-believe thing.
Another great set piece.
Yep, beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful.
It is.
Did you guys see Sandel Bergman slipped?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, when you're wearing high heels.
I like the makeup.
Yeah. I love the makeup.
It's really, really cool.
Right here. And I like how they chose to put his eyes blacked out, like like a bandit or something like that.
Yeah.
On both his eyes.
You got to love
Milius. Well, I think they thought about how they did each person's makeup.
Yeah. Milius in the early 80s, man.
He's a womanizer.
But this is so like the comics right here.
Yeah. It's certainly a fantasy sci-fi, that whole heavy metal realm.
Oh,
so this is right.
This is heavy metal.
This is really heavy metal.
Yeah.
So I feel like they visited the Caligula set.
And then why would you have a cougar in there or a leopard? Well,
why not?
It's a fantasy.
Right.
And this is probably the most true to the comics, this section right here.
Yeah.
See, I never read the comics. That's there.
Can I have a hand?
God. Oh man, this was just so.
Yeah.
Gross.
I've not shown this to my 10-year-old yet, but I did show him up until where he gets into the pit fighting, because there's really not a whole lot of violence up until that point.
Yeah,
right.
It's blood, and gore, and he loves it. I keep telling my wife, when can I start showing him? Because,
oh, man.
And to me, I use that as a governor as to what I kind of like, when a really film really does work. And when you can show it to a child and have them understand it and be engaged by it with no dialogue, with just directing and music and all that, then it works. And that's filmmaking. Talking about a great transition with the special effects of the time is this transition they do just with camera work.
Yeah.
And cutaways.
Oh.
He's becoming the snake.
Yeah. It's really
that's
neat.
That's right.
But this is a fantastic piece by Basil right here. It's awesome.
This is some Rick Baker stuff going on there.
Yeah, definitely.
I love how they cut away to the cougar, like, looking. And
now, is this post American Werewolf?
81? I don't think so.
I think it's like
think
right
80, 82, 70, right around 70, the exact
79
time.
Was.
American Werewolf London, was it that early? I'm not going
to
argue with you, but
I'm trying to remember.
It's right.
I think American Werewolf
era.
Was 79.
Was before this. Okay, so Rick Baker had already started doing this type of stuff. I mean, I think The Howling was around this time, too, which Rick Baker, I think.
It was 80, did. I think.
Yeah. Same type of thing with the transformations. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But this isn't Rick Baker, but they're definitely lifting what he does.
But look at, see how that worked? Yeah. Okay. But I think that's a great effect right there. It really works. And how he's going, preparing for battle right here. He takes it away from his behind him now, and he puts that on his hip. Just little things like that I love. Pulling out the toothpick.
It's very Slave Leia and Jabba. Yeah.
So that's where they stole. So that's puppetry, right? Yeah.
See?
Yep.
Yeah, that's really good.
How she moves on the ground like this.
Yeah, it's very fluid, dancer, athletic. Yeah.
And lights everything on fire.
Yeah. Bloom.
Okay, that's a real snake. That's a really big snake.
But the way she moves like you don't have to cut away. It all works. Even just her going over that. I know it sounds so petty and stupid to think about stuff like that, but being an athlete, when I see a guy that can't throw and he's playing a pitcher in a movie or, you know, just any kind of athleticism whatsoever, don't ever watch Nicolas Cage run for that reason, because it just drives me insane.
Well, I mean, yes. I mean, some actors can move and some actors can't, but that's not their gifts. Their gifts are otherwise. But some actors can.
No, some can.
Yeah.
There are definitely athletic actors.
Here, watch the culmination right here. Now the Basil Poulter scores twitches. Bam.
It's the best blood.
And this is where
it looks so real. Doesn't it look so real?
They have some great blood packs on here.
But that's what's good. I mean, if you're going to do it, you know, make it look real. Don't whip out.
Now, here in a minute in the hallway.
I'll throw the girl beside, but
him cutting camera, I love that. Just blam. Yeah. Then they do that. What a great edit.
Yeah.
Here in a minute when they're in the hallway fighting, when she hits one guy, she actually cuts his chin open, and she really did it on set. She actually stabs him in the neck, and you'll be able to see it.
Oh, that sucks.
And they use it, because it's a one shot.
Well, at least they got to use it.
Yeah, you know. Well, it was real blood.
At least she
did. Like right here, when he cuts right there, oh.
I love that, like, weird Mongoloid guy, too, that he's fighting. Nice. I don't know what that's about, but I like it.
Oh, they're, yeah.
He's so barbaric.
God. What?
Ooh, Thulsa's disappearing into the hole.
I like how she just manhandles his broad, like, whatever.
Yeah.
Just get back.
Snap out of it.
You know, actually, going back to the whole Saving Private Ryan, they're saving the daughter.
Yeah.
It's a...
Here, this is great right here.
Oh, there's the football player.
See that axe he's got? That's a heavy axe. And that hammer the dude has? That's a heavy hammer, but this
I
is
remember
great.
This.
Yep.
This was the most disgusting thing I'd ever seen. I'm like, oh
yeah,
my
it's
God.
But look
gross.
At this thing. Watch
it's
it bounce.
Amazing.
That is heavy.
Yeah.
That he did is amazing. I wasn't thinking that. I was thinking there's body parts and heads.
Well, that was
that's
disgusting.
Oh, yeah, and it's that green color. It's like grandma's pea soup green.
Yeah. See, he remembers him. He remembers him.
Right.
There's our full title theme.
Yeah. I love the camera work here is great, how they just come right around the front.
Mm-hmm. Excellent set.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful set.
Now, watch right here whenever he's carrying that huge hammer and he's swinging it. So when he hits that, it doesn't seem unbelievable that he could knock over this pillar in a second.
No. And you can see when he's lifting that hammer over his head, you can actually see his muscles.
Bam. Like, yeah, exactly.
From the weight of it.
Well, right. Yeah.
And that sucker clearly is heavy.
Yeah. And the way the pillar falls apart, you know, it falls apart in an authentic type of way. It's not just, you know, it starts to slowly crumble.
Yeah, it's believable. That looked full size.
Awesome.
That didn't look like a miniature.
No, that was full scale.
He's like, ooh, hey.
Where are you?
Oh, whatever.
The wigs in this movie actually are really great.
Yeah.
I mean,
believe
they
you me,
really,
it can take
really
me
are.
Out of a movie when you have a bad wig.
Yeah.
Like, really? Right here is whenever she stabs this dude. Not right here, but here in a second when she's coming up behind him. But I love the shadows over here of her on the walls, lapping this
She
guy.
Moves really, really well. I mean,
but look at Arnold. He's carrying this chick on his back
and
running.
He's running.
There you go. It's about as fast as you can run anyway, but.
Right.
These little mongoloid characters chasing her. But right here, one of the guys in the white suit, she's going to hit him in the chin. Even though he does have a blood pack on everything else, I heard the story that she actually really did blast him on accident.
With the edge of a sword?
Yeah. Like, well, you'll see it.
Under the chin? That is not good.
Watch.
I love that.
Like, you'll see it.
Bring it on.
It gets him. Watch.
Yeah, really. Wham.
It got him.
Yeah.
Oh. And he's like, I'm really bleeding. Help me. There's a head.
It nailed him.
On this. Oh, man.
That was some party.
Yeah, that's right.
Time to go home.
But, too much beer, dude.
Last call.
You know, it becomes a reoccurring theme with me, but notice how few cuts there were and how nice of shots and great action sequence.
Well, you can see everybody's full body movement because they're actually
everything.
Well, that's
choreographed.
Yeah.
Our pet peeve where it's overcut so you can't see any fight choreography.
Yeah.
Right. So you actually want to see the shot and you want to see it happen.
Yeah, you want to see the people fight. That's the best part.
Well, what was it? I was reading an article of John Milius, and he said that they were just talking about how most films nowadays, not only do you have bad writing, but you have bad directing. He said, but directing's easy, when they were talking to him about Spielberg or something like that. And he's like, directing's easy. You can teach somebody the mechanics of directing in 3 hours. I was like, ooh. And it was his way of kind of showing that there's more to a film than just all the things they put into it. And you know, just writing is a big thing with him.
I'm trying to remember what he's doing.
He's making a snake arrow.
You need the snake arrow, and he's going to shoot it at... Oh, that's right. That's how we get Sandal Bergman.
Look at this great shot. All one take. Boop.
Sad.
Mm-hmm. That's in the comics, in the book?
I don't know. Mostly, like, the things that I've read. I haven't read this specific story. I don't know if this is actually a specific story.
I don't think they took anything. I think they just pulled together the
story,
a few of the ideas.
Yeah, because a lot of them are like little like one-shot stories. Yeah, it's like little here's an adventure here, an adventure there. Kind of, you know, very kind of heavy metal-ish.
Right. Yeah, and Conan's very mythological.
Yeah.
And fantasy, so. This is a great shot of him pulling the snake out right here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then watch when he pulls it out and it's an actual snake. You know?
Cool.
Pretty neat.
They must have had great snake wranglers on this set.
Oh, yeah.
Oh. It's really sad.
That's why it's good, baby. She's actually helping him go on. He's going to kill more people now. See, with good writing, good music, good directing, you get good scenes like that.
That's not a good look.
Awesome.
No.
Awesome.
Well, it definitely makes it the hero's darkest hour.
See, something else Lucas stole from Milius is the burning when they do Vader later. Oh,
Vader later.
Are you talking about that film, the third, Revenge of the Jedi?
That film. By the way, has some of the best moments of any Star Wars films in it. Everybody likes to pan that film, but
I love that film.
It's got some fantastic.
Oh, you're talking about Return of the Jedi.
Return of the Jedi.
Return of the Jedi. I was talking about Revenge of the Jedi. Yeah, the film
that was the original name.
The film that he was supposed to make that he didn't make.
Found one up there.
I don't know. Yes, I like Return, but I have my issues with it.
And then here is another
amazingly... It's the third best Star Wars movie.
Yes, it is. You're right. It is the third best Star Wars movie.
This is an amazing line right here by Jerry Lopez, and very well done by Jerry Lopez.
What
and
he say?
Nobody that's not an actor, where he says, Conan will not cry, so I cry for him. It's a great, great, great character point.
Which could have come from the fact that Schwarzenegger wasn't able to cry. So they have someone who can cry for Arnold.
Yeah.
It works both ways. Another hand in glove moment.
It's good casting and good writing. It's good casting and good writing for the actor.
It gives great character development for both characters. That's what makes great writing sometimes, is the fact that it says that about him, but what a great moment for Jerry Lopez.
Oh, here it goes. No more.
Yep. Nice putting on the...
What was the pendant?
That was the one we were talking about earlier that he had been wearing the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
He got it from his slave days.
Right. Yeah. Oh, okay. So basically the implication is that he was too soft before.
No, he's just making another transition.
Right.
Another...
So he's going even further.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't think he was
too
soft.
Well, what he was wearing before was a reminder of what he came up from.
Exactly.
Right.
And now what he's wearing is a reminder of who he is and who he's doing this for.
And he's breaking free.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And now he's moving beyond.
In a lot of ways, too, it's kind of like, you know, putting something on the hood of your car that you're going to go get this guy. I mean, he's now wearing the necklace that he originally stole from False of Doom that kind of started this whole thing.
Yeah. But he also essentially, I guess accomplished part of the mission.
Great camera.
You know, he did save the daughter, of course. She's completely brainwashed.
Yeah. And that great shot. But here's the added scene, by the way. This was not in the original theatrical cut. This is only on the DVD version of the special edition. And this is what they cut out because the studio didn't like it. They thought that Arnold wasn't a good actor.
What does the scene do?
Well, listen. It basically tells him he's just reliving a story of his youth.
Okay.
Arnold must have been pissed.
Well, he does a good job in it. I mean, he's not Laurence Olivier, but he does a good job in it.
I like how in the background she's still chained up there.
With a big reflector on her.
That's right.
basically saying, let's get it over with now.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I like about this, you really get the sense of how, you know, it's just the two of them now and they do miss her, which is interesting.
Yeah. Well, they're also coming to the realization that they're meant to do these things. They're warriors. They're, right. This is what they do. And they do, and what he was saying right there is if we don't do it now, we'll be somewhere else doing it again. So right. let's get it over with.
Right.
And in a lot of ways, essentially, they think they're going to die.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Now, interestingly enough, this was made like, you know, late 70s, early 80s. And one thing we've kind of grown way far beyond is back in the 60s and 70s. I mean, there was a lot of cults, essentially, that pulled people in and people joined them. So I think there's a bit of a commentary on that, or at least not a commentary necessarily, but it was part of the culture, more of the culture of that time, of knowing people who went into cults and had to be gotten out and deprogrammed,
right.
That kind of thing. And that's kind of gone by the wayside for the most part. Mako, you rock.
But it's also a really great way of attaching this sort of ancient world to our own ancient world, because some of our oldest, you know, cultures and civilizations also practice such things.
Right.
So, again, cements it a little bit more in two ways into our own reality.
And I agree with you all, but right here, I got to stop you. Yes. This is an amazing shot, and his cameraman said this couldn't be done. So John Milius said, it can be done. I know I've read it. And he actually pulled out a book over lunch.
Yeah.
It was like a little camera book. And they're about 150 feet behind him right now, so they could get two of these in a shot. And John Milius is like, I know it can work. And then so John Milius actually got his camera guy to shoot it. And it works. And he just looked it up on the day.
You're saying just to be so telephoto?
So you can have those in focus in the background, the horses on the ridge over there.
Oh, so basically they had to be far back for
exactly.
both.
Exactly. So he's like, I know I can
field.
Do it.
Okay.
But and the camera guy's like, you can't do that. It won't work.
It was very smooth. That's what the problem
dolly
was.
Dolly shot and everything.
That's tough in terms of the move. And once again, you can see, I mean, they have her composed in the back.
But
she's in there.
And this is a great, what I love about this whole sequence, I mean, if you're a guy and you have any sort of testosterone going through your body whatsoever, how this buildup is building to this final culmination fight and the music coming in here and then his little monologue right here, it's an amazing piece. And then them doing this whole setup where they're actually planning out the battle. So like when you saw Subutai putting down the arrows in the ground and everything, this is all going to play out later. So, and then this monologue is a great monologue. Then to
hell, it's the fort, and you're preparing for the attack of whoever, you name them, the bugs and Starship Troopers. The bugs are coming.
It's nice to have the dialogue over all this stuff.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that, I mean, this gives Emilius a chance to really talk about, you know, the nature of battle combat and even to a certain extent war.
Yeah.
Because it's not necessarily war. This is just combat.
But this is a very classic situation.
Yeah.
But what a moment right there for him to say, you know what? He's not lying. He's being honest. I want one thing. I want revenge.
Well, yeah. Well, that's the whole thing.
And then
it's
also have a legacy of knowing that two men stood against many.
And, I mean, there's been a lot of
this
revenge stories.
Isn't it holding this great music?
If you even look at, you know, different revenge stories tell their stories differently.
Bam. First punch. Right again. Blam.
Yeah. Cut them in half. Boom.
But, you know, when you're carrying a 50-pound sword and you hit somebody, that usually happens.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Which is great.
He's kidding people. We enjoy it. I like the zoom. You see, that zoom was good. I'll accept that zoom.
Yeah, it actually was a really great zoom.
Awesome.
It just goes to show you anything's good in moderation.
When well used.
Yeah.
And not lazily used.
Yeah. But then in this battleground, it all makes sense. The way they fortified themselves, how they will be able to possibly stand up against these many guys is great.
Right.
Great horse falls.
It's a great place to stage, basically stage a battle.
Oh.
Nice blood packs.
They're beautiful. They're like just the right color of red.
And the nice
the spatter.
The spatter.
It's not outrageous. It's just,
I like that it's not digital blood movies coming out.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the digital blood is convincing, but they make it work here really well. Oh.
That's great. Then it shows both of them helping each other out.
But the fun thing about having actual blood on set is that it gets on things you wouldn't have necessarily planned on. because it's just the nature of, you know, something happening right in front of
now,
you.
Now, this is right. What bugs me most about the score.
Yes.
This part right here is not in the CD. And I love this little plucking of the strings right here. Listen. Just that little.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just great.
You know, this reminds me, actually, Tim, you and I were talking earlier. This reminds me of when I read years ago the I Am Legend script that Mark Protasevich wrote, mm-hmm. and I talked to you about that. And part of what Neville's thing, at least in that script, was that he essentially fortified himself like this on a hill with all sorts of ramparts and I don't know what they're called, with spikes all around against, you know, the mutants, the vampires. Oh, you can't hit Conan.
That would hurt.
That's not
that
nice.
Would hurt. Everything in this battle looks like it would hurt immensely.
This is great right here.
Yes.
It's a great stunt. Great everything. Oh, listen to that. Da-down. Not in the score. Damn it.
That's the football player, right?
Yeah.
Oh. He just cut the horse.
You got to do these things in battle. Man. That's what you got to love.
But you know what's fantastic is that he really just did not cut that horse.
Yes.
And that was so well choreographed.
So well choreographed, yeah. Yeah.
It's the magic of filmmaking.
They didn't have to show blood. They didn't have to show anything, and you believe it.
Yeah. Exactly. You can kill the guy, but don't kill the horse.
No, don't ever kill the horse.
Don't kill the horse.
Although that's exactly what you would do.
Well,
yeah, hey.
Basically,
it's one of those
yes.
things in real life people don't want to think about. Oof.
Oh, that's Mako. Okay.
Moment of levity.
I can't get up.
Guys are in their element.
There's the
this
guy.
This is a great
the
payoff.
The guy with the hammer.
A great payoff.
It's Thor.
When they built it. Like, I got him.
That's a big hammer.
This is awesome, right? And watch his hitting.
Oh! That was a sweet contraption. Oh.
There was
see, look at that.
Camera blood splatter.
Oh, that's great. The great setup PFs. And once again, look at that shield he's got. It's a real shield.
Yeah.
So when they're fighting.
That's not Thulsa, is it?
Yeah. He's been sitting up there like
oh,
most
it is
guys.
Thulsa.
Blood's on the lens on the lower left.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Which would never, ever have happened
watch.
With digital
Bam.
Blood.
Now, see how big this guy is compared to Arnold. He's like 6'6".
Yeah.
So yeah, he's a giant.
And just a naturally big dude.
Yeah.
But athletic.
What?
Is that angelic Sandal Bergman?
This is a great.
Yeah, see, I haven't seen this in so long. But
it's Starbuck.
This is a great. This is my favorite part of Basil's score.
Thank
right
you
here.
For
this,
getting that, Heidi.
This piece right here.
Oh, I got it.
And the way it combines with the fight, listen to it.
This is on the soundtrack album?
Yes. It times it with the sword. Blam. Remember,
wow.
we saw him the whole movie. Now, that's his dad's sword he just cut in half.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I thought Thulsa had
Bam.
It, but okay. Oh. The sword work and just the blood work and everything is just amazing.
Watch you.
Nice.
Watch you splatter up.
Yeah.
Well, the thing it's so good because it's convincing. It's not
great.
It's not. Well, it is a little over the top, but
it's
over the
slightly.
Top. It's convincing.
It's
that's
Conan
the whole
over
thing.
The top.
Yeah, it's Conan.
It's acceptable.
Top.
Conan
yeah.
over the top. Yeah,
but it's like even you know when Verhoeven did you know RoboCop or Starship Troopers with the gore, you still believed it because it you know it wasn't silly. Well,
it
was good silly.
Yeah, good.
What'd
silly.
You think about that music with the movie?
Oh,
I liked it. Very heroic.
It's
very propulsive.
Yeah.
Writing-wise, you see, now here he set it up already with the whole snake with the arrow, and I was going to do it again. Oh. Go, Jerry.
Subutai. See, now so that now he's looking back, and that's his father's sword this whole time.
Mm.
I tell you, they direct, I mean, the way John Milius shot Arnold in this, he looks fantastic. Looks like right there they didn't shoot it with the right speed of film and slowed it down.
Well, no, they did that in post. Basically, they did a slow motion.
What I'm saying
is
they didn't plan for it. You know what I mean?
And in that certain optical, it was very scratched up. Yeah. I'm wondering if that was the way it originally was.
That got damaged.
This is very nice.
This night shoot's very
good. And you die for it, too, because the first time you see everybody at the temple, you just want to see it at night. You want to see the lights. You want to see it. You're just waiting for this.
This is where Blu-ray would really come into play.
And all I'm thinking right now, production was that's a lot of pyro. That's a lot of flames people
now,
are holding out there.
This is also a new piece that isn't in the original, all of him kind of sneaking around and killing all these guys.
Oh.
In the original theatrical cut.
Yeah.
It's got those scratches on there where it was on the frame?
Yeah.
That's where they added it in.
Wow.
But yeah, this is all. Now, there's some of this is in the original, but not all of it. So they added, like this is added. This is not in the original theatrical cut
and
of
this
her coming back.
That's the daughter, okay.
Yeah, you didn't see her coming back in the original. So now she's no longer under there. She's no longer.
So the spell
was
broken.
She's not held back by Subutai and Mako. She's coming back as well. And you see her kind of, and she brings him in. This is not in the original theatrical.
Got it. I bet this fits perfectly well.
Oh, I like it. I love the added footage. I think it really works. Arnold's still getting out some anger back there.
I know. He's just like, I am taking you out. Now, is the part with Thulsa Doom up there?
Yeah,
that
that's all in.
Okay,
that's
but it's just this part here.
This part right here where you basically think that he kind of snuck in the theatrical version. You never see her again after that hillside scene.
What is she doing?
I like how they have him out of focus and them in focus in these shots.
She's just walking.
I agree. It's good.
The daughter's just walking around like she's all.
She's really spaced out, though. I mean,
she's
she was brainwashed.
Funky.
Yeah.
She's just not.
So basically after this originally theatrical cut, we didn't see her again?
This right here, you never saw this. So all of this with her coming, with her in there with him, you didn't see. You just saw him coming back and kind of like washes of him kind of washing frame.
I like this.
Yeah, I do too.
I like it a lot.
Man.
So if we're supposed to believe that she's much better and not under anyone's control.
Yeah, she's no longer under a spell and she sees him for
who he is. Her trance-like whole stupor is not doing that for me.
Yeah.
Well, but that's what I was saying is that what was with the... I got to say, this reminds me of Lost Horizon. I'm sorry.
Shangri-La.
Yes.
Now, this is, that right there is from the original.
Yeah, I can see that.
So that's really all you kind of get is him showing up.
And.
Yeah, that's right. Back down.
That's right. I love the flare.
It's very good because right here you actually see he almost falls under a spell again. It's very well done.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the idea. He's really...
But what's nice about that scene that they cut, that they showed earlier where he was talking about his father when he was younger, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. actually would have been really fitting for you to see coming into this scene because that's what he's holding on to. Mm-hmm. This man's trying to convince him, I'm your like your father. I'm trying to bring you under my spell. And he clearly has something he's holding on to that's keeping him away mm-hmm. from this. And it's
right.
it's his own family.
Just something about having Darth Vader's voice mm-hmm. saying, my son, my, it mm-hmm. brings to mind other movies.
You know, mm-hmm. I don't know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. No idea. None.
But now notice that's his dad's sword.
Right.
It's not his other sword.
Boom.
Yeah. And what a great.
He just like,
hey, if you're going to cut somebody's head off, you might as well start at the clavicle.
Well, you got to start somewhere if you can't get a clear shot.
And this is gruesome.
And if you hate someone, you might as well just give them a little torture first.
That's right. I mean. You get one side, then you get the other, and then you basically kick the body over the edge.
I love the sound effect, too, of him. When
crane shot. Crane shot.
Oh, that's an awesome shot. And then you see everyone.
Hello.
See, he's showing him just human. Yes. Just human.
And then, just for added effect.
Just listen to this, like.
Oh, That was and it's like, rude. It just falls down.
Just, they keep this.
See, I mean, like, but I mean, even at the time, I mean, that was
look
pretty,
how he's letting go.
But that was pretty gruesome back in 81 to see this on a major motion picture. Holy crap. Mm. It was.
I've always liked films that show the brutality of violence, and it's one problem I do have with the kind of like, you know, the campy kind of violence you might see in a Temple of Doom or something like that. It's like, listen, violence is violence.
Well, yeah. It's cause and effect. You don't yeah. see the effect of it.
Exactly.
And you detach because of it.
Yeah. And in something like this, man, the brutality of cutting off somebody's head, it will be 100 times worse than what we just saw. But it's just like, mm-hmm. you know, when you just, it's kind of interesting that so much of Hollywood is run by liberal people, but then they make cartoon caricatures of violence.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, wait a minute. You're the people that are always speaking against violence. Why not show the violence for what it is instead of actually making money and kind of like, you know, fictionalizing it in the point of way where it makes it seem fun.
I don't think it's necessarily...
I knew I'd get Surge on that one.
A liberal thing.
I
think it's more a matter. I think it's more a matter of trying to stick to what will I call it? A more of a mainstream. Well, we want to show violence, but we can't show it too bad.
No,
because
and
we don't
and
want
I'm
because,
not saying
because
that.
We don't want to offend people. That,
of course, 100%. I agree.
And that just
you.
And that just waters it down. And that's why somewhere here where he's able to actually assert his vision is great. Or even in Tarantino films, especially the earlier ones. I mean that's what was you know kind of seminal of that
great
because
days.
Because the violence. So it's like, oh my God, I'm seeing violence. I don't want to see the violence kind of thing. And I think it's more a matter of, you know, how do you deal with violence in films honestly
mm-hmm.
so that it can actually have an impact. And you're right. And when it doesn't, that's one thing I don't like about Mission Impossible 2. They took out, if you watch the editing, they took out all the hits, all the body
that's
hits.
That's one thing you don't like about Mission Impossible 2?
That's one thing.
There are many things I don't like, but that was the main thing. And it drove me crazy because it was a John Woo film. It's like, okay, I want to see the, you know, the hits. And it's like you see nothing. No blood yeah. splatter, nothing.
Well,
no consequence.
Yeah, there's no consequences. And this is
right.
an added shot, by the way.
And it's
that was in the original.
And it all makes sense. It all works really well.
See, now she's...
Now he needs to throw her in.
Yeah. Well, in a lot of ways, it's showing how he becomes kind of King Conan. And once again, this is another shot that wasn't in the original. But
shocking.
Because after this, this was supposed to lead to the movie King Conan and everything else. That was John Milius' idea.
Right.
And this is all fitting for that because it's his transition to the place of power now where people want to follow him and kind of... So all of that right there.
Great yeah. shot, her with the yeah. in the foreground, all that depth behind.
So this essentially is a new ending in a way.
No. It still all ends the exact same way. They just added those couple of shots. He really did do this in the other film. They didn't have that cutaway to her doing it.
Okay.
They just had him throwing, and they didn't have that shot of her.
So they cut her out of the ending.
Yeah, they cut her out of all of that.
Wow.
So... And actually,
well, I guess
once
they didn't have her, and you know, if you didn't see her coming in to the temple with him to right. have her now suddenly at the pool would have.
Yeah. And like this right here, it's the same thing that was never seen in the original.
Right.
So it's just an extended sequence of all the shots of her and him together.
But I don't see
it's almost like an implication that she would be the queen and he would be the king.
Yeah. Well, in some way. Yeah. And then they kind of go off together or.
Maybe,
well, or he just takes her back to his father. Her father.
Well, maybe they would rule both kingdoms.
Yeah,
and you know, like, yeah. it kind of.
Well,
gets
he burns
that
this one up.
Open endings.
So.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, actually, if I remember right, I've only seen this a couple of times. This version,
oh, and
but
he
I
just
think
walks
he, yeah,
by.
I think he denies her. That's what it is, no. and she was ready to accept him as.
But he turns for a moment. This, I mean, this changes the scene completely. This changes
it.
The ending completely. I mean, in a good way. I like it. I like it very much.
And here's another piece, Tim, that isn't in this music you're hearing right now isn't on this score soundtrack. Mm. And it's a great piece.
It's a good resolution.
This is like, I mean, when I said it was a new ending, in a way it's a new ending because before all he did is he destroyed the temple.
Yeah.
Here, he destroyed the temple, but... He once because a big thing in this film, and she's there,
yeah.
was his whole connection with Sandel Bergman,
mm-hmm.
and that he was able to have that kind of relationship. And here he's like, "We're going."
Yeah, that's a great shot.
They burn the set.
Yeah. Yep.
And nice. He, look at that.
And look at the skylight out
yeah.
there.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And he carries her.
Is that a painting? That's
yeah, it looks
be.
Like a mat.
Now wait, when the film ended, didn't end with him carrying
nope.
her, did it?
Before it just ended with it burning up and him going off, and then they show him on his throne.
That's
I like
right.
this.
But
there
you go.
It. But this is an iconic Conan shot right there.
So this is part of the original release.
Yes. I think they added that dialogue, that very last piece. This
oh, did they?
Sure are also be told, if I remember right.
Oh, okay.
It does say all the king by his own hand and all that stuff, but
it's sort of like, you know, at the end of Buckaroo Banzai. Buckaroo Banzai will return. Things like the League of...
What are you talking about? No.
Hey.
But come on. Seriously, one of the most underrated films of the 80s, in my opinion. Still, back to me.
One of?
One of.
Do you think it's underrated?
I do. I mean, as far as like film aficionados, I mean, now there's always a culture of people that have fandom yeah. for it and everything
this
else.
This is held
I'm not
in very
those.
High regard.
Well,
with fan circles. I mean,
yeah,
film.
With fan circles. But if you mention things like, well, in the critical world of, you know,
right.
film, you know, lore. It's like,
but if you, you know, you mention a lot of great things in the critical film world of lore or whatever, they don't recognize a lot
yeah,
of
I
things.
Think legit, yeah. legit course, yeah. circles view this as cheesy.
Yeah, yeah.
I well, mean, because of the, probably mostly because yeah. of the fantasy background.
Yeah.
You know, it's very rare that something is based in any sort of fantasy and people of a legit circle would take it seriously. There's very few films like that.
Yeah. Lord of the Rings being one of the first that really kind of
yeah.
was accepted.
Yeah.
But it really wasn't even accepted until the overwhelming wealth that it brought the film industry.
Well,
it's like Warner Brothers and everybody else. Then
well,
all of a sudden
mean,
got
still
accolades.
People though, because I mean, and this is kind of unrelated, but I was playing Trivial Pursuit with some people the other day, and one of the questions came up, and it was about Lord of the Rings: Return of the King being the longest title for a film ever to win an Oscar. But the answer was, you know, Lord of the Rings: Return of the King, and nobody could remember that this is what won the Oscar in 2004. Mm-hmm. And then when I read the answer, they seemed surprised.
Yeah,
it's just, oh, that movie it won an Oscar.
Mm. Yeah,
it won a Best Picture Oscar, and yeah. everyone seemed a little shocked by that.
Yeah,
I mean, when I saw this in movies, I from what I remember, it did well. It was
well.
It was a hit.
It was a hit.
It was a great hit for Arnold Schwarzenegger. And I mean, the one thing watching this here, what I really like about it is that there's a, I guess, a more mature aesthetic. It's like an adult directed this.
For adults. Or 7 or 8 year olds.
Yeah.
That girls.
That girls who yeah. are 7 or 8 years old who watch it with their fathers, but who can at least watch an adult movie. See, look at all the
and
Spanish names.
Grew up completely, like, back to the conversation we were having, though, about showing what happens, real violence has real repercussions. You know, I get this a lot from people who are a little shocked that I grew up watching the kind of violence that I did and the kind of just the mature.
Yeah. And you're also not warped and you're not doing black tar heroin.
No.
And, you know, yeah,
you know
exactly.
Like I think I'm perfectly well adjusted. I think I turned out just fine. I think I know right from wrong. But I think that being when you're exposed to something that's a little bit more truthful
true.
And not that's a little bit not as held back, you have more respect for it.
Well, sure.
Yeah, I mean,
yay, Conan! You taught me.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you're sheltered from reality and just given fantasy, and you have no idea of at least some concept of the consequences, even dealing, I mean, through fiction, which allows us to learn things we can't normally in life. Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. If you stab someone, they will bleed.
They will bleed. They will hurt. And they will die. And this movie was shot entirely on location in Spain.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Nice.
Special thanks to Alfredo.
Who's Alfredo?
I don't know.
There it is. Well, for those who would like to see another John Milius film, you can go. Well, some way, shape, or form, he was a writer on Jeremiah Johnson, Dirty Harry, Apocalypse Now, Dillinger, Magnum Force, The Wind and the Lion, Rough Riders, a fantastic underrated Western, Big Wednesday, 1941. Red Dawn, Farewell to the King, Flight of the Intruder, The Hunt for Red October, Clear and Present Danger, and the list goes on and on and on. The guy was...
But the two big things is he did direct Red Dawn.
Did... No, no, no.
Didn't he?
No.
No?
Whoa. He wrote Red Dawn.
No.
Red Dawn is fantastic.
Who directed Red Dawn?
I don't think
I
he did.
I thought he did.
If he did, I apologize, John Milius. It's shame on me if he did. But I don't think he did. I think he wrote
But he did write and direct The Wind and the Lion, yes. 1975.
Sean Connery.
With Sean Connery.
Candace Bergen.
And Brian Keith as Teddy Roosevelt.
That's right. Jerry Goldsmith.
Really, really good film. Really holds up well.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you know what? The more you say it, I think he might have directed Red Dawn.
I think that was...
I should be slapped across the face.
We might have to fact check that.
Yes.
Where's the IMDb?
Well, we use
the IMDb is somewhere, but you know, we use it to kind of record this thing, so we'll wait. So, that was a pretty good film.
That was great.
It was fun.
Yeah.
It's been a while. It was nice.
It's been a long time.
It was time.
To revisit your youth, Heidi?
Yep.
That's right. But actually,
warm and fuzzy.
I got to say, I think this is the first time I've seen it fully like this since I saw it in the movie theaters.
Wow.
And I think it holds up. It holds up here in the year of 2010.
Well, that's what's cool about a period piece done well. It'll not age as far as holding up because the time period is ancient and it always will, and modern times won't date that.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask a question of our Conan aficionados. So what happened with Conan the Destroyer? What was the deal with that?
Would you like to say?
Well, what do you mean? What's the
you
deal
mean like
with
in
that?
The Hollywood ways?
Well, what happened? Why did Milius? Thank you. Why did it suck? Why did Milius not direct it? And you know, I guess I'm assuming write it. I mean, what happened there?
John Milius. I mean, I don't know the definitive answer for that or the correct one. I would say, but I can tell you that by his standards in Hollywood, they didn't get along real well. He basically told people. During Rough Riders, for instance, the Western I was talking about, it's a great Western, and it's very violent, and he just had hell getting that made because they were always giving him script notes and things and do this and do that, and it was one of the first movies he'd ever really gotten that much do this and do this kind of thing, and he was just hell on the studios because he was like, I'm not going to do that, I'm not going to do this, and or he would say, yeah, I'll do it, and then he wouldn't do it, and then he would just shoot the movie he wanted to shoot. And they don't like dealing with that. So I would assume that had something to do with it. Maybe he was asked, or maybe he did put some input into it. I think he might have been a producer on it just for the sheer fact of the fact that he had some rights or something like that onto it. But I don't know the exact reason. But
yeah, I don't know either.
He wasn't a friend of many Hollywood studios.
But it's clear that they just pumped that movie out to just make some money off of the success of Arnold Schwarzenegger, who he was becoming after Terminator. So, that could have a lot to do with it too, because you know whenever a movie or a concept is rushed out, it's pretty clear that it's going to turn out to be a not well made film.
And speaking of that, I mean, if you ever go back and watch that film 3 or 4 years later than this film, it doesn't hold up. The blue screen everywhere.
Oh yeah, it's
no
cheezo.
Practical sets.
But if if you want to watch something that's so bad it's good,
yeah. That is one of them.
Which unfortunately is all too often the case with sequels.
Yeah.
That actually budgets are cut on sequels and everything suffers accordingly.
Yeah.
They try to make the same story again.
Right. Yeah.
They're just milking it.
That's all they did. Yeah. They were rescuing another girl. And
they want a bigger profit from a smaller investment.
Yeah.
This would make a really good TV series.
Oh yeah,
the whole Conan story
on.
I mean, and building up over
a couple of times.
Conan sort of like Hercules, though, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Sort
well,
like...
no, I think they had a Conan not too many years ago.
I'm thinking they maybe like did try and do it.
They had Sheena.
It wasn't successful.
It would be a good series if they did it well, like a Rome or something. I would really like to see that type of a series.
But I mean, where you can take these arcs of where he wound up and then tell these stories over a few years, and I think you could have something.
So you're saying through
there's tons of story. I mean, there's so much more story to Conan than is even, just captured in this one movie.
And actually, that's a really interesting thing. This covered a hell of a lot of territory from his youth up through a lot of things, and that script handled it really, really well, because you can watch some movies like, oh my God, it's clunky as all.
It flowed very well.
And we probably should mention that, I was always saying Milius, but, you got Oliver Stone as a writer with him, so the two of them together wrote this. And a matter of fact, I think the first draft, Oliver Stone wrote the complete first draft, and then Milius came in, and the two of them
was starting off, and he was, really starting to pick up speed. I think he had written Midnight Express already, and then he was moving on. I think I don't know what he did next, but of course he did Salvador, and then of course he did Platoon, which he won Academy Awards for. Yeah. I think he won several. I mean, excellent writer. So yeah, definitely in his younger days when he definitely had that.
The Hand was Oliver Stone.
That was the first Oliver Stone film he directed.
I highly recommend it to anybody.
Michael Caine.
Michael Caine. So. Can't even.
Michael Caine.
Talking about somebody, I mean, last one, that can easily pull off cheese and do it well. In that movie, he's fantastic.
Michael right? Caine.
Just in the hand. I've never seen it.
Oh, he's a mustache twirler in that one. He's like, it's great. But anyway, off subject.
All right. Well, any last words?
I have to pee.
Oh, no. Great.
All right. Fantastic film.
It was awesome.
Yay.
It was good. Thanks for bringing this up. I'm really glad we saw it. So, great. Thank you, everybody. And we'll see you next time.